All right. Level 20, episode 10, refresh. I'm Connor Smith, your host, Level 1 Summer Intern. Big year, big podcast. We got a lot of stuff for you. We did a while with Kyle Decker and Tom Wallace again, talking about their involvement in the movie. Got a little bit of their take on the Warren Miller saga, and also talked about the Joss edit. So that's about the first half of this. And then after that, we did a deep dive with just Josh and Friedel on all of the backstory to the Warren Miller saga, the lawsuit, the fallout, everything about it. And then at the end, answered some listener questions. So hope you enjoy. Got a ton of good stuff in there. As always, email us questions, podcast@level1productions.com. You can go pre-order Romance right now. You can buy your tickets to the Denver premiere, to the Salt Lake premiere on the Level 1 website, level1.ski. You can check out the events page if you want to host your own showing. And tell your friends about the pod if you're enjoying. Let's get into it. Episode 10. Here we go. Thanks for listening, y'all. Same deal here. Let's get it going then, since time is short. Why don't we start off, since it's the intro, doing this little tidbit about your guys' take on the Warren Miller stuff, and then move on real quick.
Okay. Yeah.
Kyle, I heard you were not the most enthused about this idea when it came down the pipe.
I don't know. I don't actually remember that, but I have a bad memory. I know I was at first. Back then, we were all so hesitant on keeping the Level 1 like brand authentic and like to the core. And initially, you know, you're hesitant because you're branching such a different, two different worlds. And if not done properly, it could come across as unauthentic, but I think Berman did a pretty good job. He kind of was mostly all in dealing with the, interview with Warren Miller and kind of just putting it all together, that I think he made it work. But I was hesitant on, I don't know.
I remember some.
We had such good scene for that exact conversation.
Yeah, go for it. I was going to jump in there.
So we were out at, I think it was late June. We were out at Wendell's for a round two on a jump session.
Okay.
And this year, in 2008, Josh and I had gone out to film it. This year, Kyle came out as well. And everyone was, the entire crew was there again. Huge crew that year, including like Duncan Adams and all these random people. But, Josh got the emails from Greg Heidel.
Text, I think. We were all sleeping on these dirty mattresses on the floor of the Wendell's coach house.
Yeah, we're at the like adult house at Wendell's / like, adult housing, whatever that house was. But we were all, sleeping. It was dark, and he was like, yo, guys, this is a better, as good of a time as any to just mention this, but I just came through the pipes that, like, through Greg Heidel, who was a mutual friend of ours for a while, that Warren Miller, the human being, would be interested in potentially collaborating with us on any level of, like, participation for a movie. And he's like, since it is like our 10th movie, maybe it could be an opportune time to like do something like that. And Decker's knee jerk from the gut reaction, which is totally super valid, was like, basically, I don't know what you said, Kyle, but it was like, oh hell no. Yeah. It was like, that is against everything we stand for. And then some. And like, to go that route would be the ultimate sellout / death / like, what do we even stand for? Move just for the sake of what? Like, having some old guy from generations before, basically, like, and the making movies that we did not relate to, certainly in like the late 90s.
Right.
This is what kind of the counterculture at the time.
Yeah. Exactly. 100% we were. We were making a new form of like action sports movie, if you will, to like rebel against that. So the very idea of joining forces in that way, I think, was very revolting to you. That was super valid, I thought.
I will say that, I was equal parts excited and a little bit perturbed by the concept as well. I wasn't like, oh, this is the greatest idea ever. Fuck yeah. Because, yeah, for very obvious reasons that we discussed, and we'll definitely get into more detail later, there was this thought that how and why would this fit? Like, there's no correlation between Warren Miller and Warren Miller Films as I know them and what Level One is doing in 2009 with tall tees and dubs and
street skiing.
And street skiing. Like,
we were sitting on the best footage Level One has ever had to date by far that year.
That's another excellent point.
It was a special year, man.
Yes, it was, dude. Like, I don't think we were in any situation where we needed a freaking handout from like a god above to make enhance our movie in any way. Mm-hmm. In fact, like we had Josh and I had an interview earlier, like a few weeks ago with Ethan Stone, about Level One's history. And I was like, dude, in my humble opinion, I think that Refresh is where we finally became like a player in the game. Like it was finally like, all of these guys that we're working with, like this crew is now like the best motherfuckers in skiing.
Absolutely.
Like we are now like, this is it. Like we kind of arrived like as a whole entity, like everyone involved, like Wallace, DeLorme. I mean, I can name drop all day long,
Henry.
But like that entire roster, it's like now like this is like the strongest we've ever been and like debatably ever were. Like,
and
this
I would
is
say
like,
on
we
both
arrived.
Sides of the lens too, because I feel like we were covering all bases. We all had our strengths. We were all working together in such an awesome collaborative way where Friedel, you and Kyle and I think all brought different strengths to the table that just fused. And it was awesome. It was really great. It was really a special time, but yeah, we did not need anything. And the other irony of this whole situation, of course, is that this concept was sort of suggested in late June. I mean, we're like 2 months away from premiering a movie, and like we've been shooting for it. Like this was the final like shots that we were putting in the can during that Hood session, and that was the end of the line. It's like,
right.
Yeah, we're pretty much like done shooting this movie, and we're like probably well into like figuring out how to put it all together, and.
Decker's already editing New Era. He's already got half that movie done.
Yeah, but it was just like a curveball, and it was like, does this help? Do we move forward with this? Like, where are we going?
It was so left field and such a big name, though, that it was like, whoa.
Gotta like, consider this.
You can't immediately say no, because it's so strange, but like,
and not
like
to
such
mention,
an iconic name.
I feel like it sounds like we're almost saying it in a negative way, but not to mention, if you're handed that opportunity that like is a once in a lifetime opportunity, you better damn do it right. Like,
yeah,
and I'm
well,
sure
that was
a little nerves. Like, do we have the capacity, the time, and like, can we?
Absolutely. Well, that came from both our side and it came from Warren's side as well, because, you know, not for nothing, this was a very big move on his part or their part, should I say, including his stepson, Colin, and his team over there. I mean, this is, you know, a big deal. And I feel like there were a million different ways that it could have been done, and 998,000 of them would have been a flop.
Yeah, it would have been, it could have easily been pretty gross.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like just a weird interjection from like a voice from skiing past.
And think about
like, what the fuck is this?
How like serious. I mean, I feel like at that time we kind of represented, or at least in our eyes, like we wanted to speak to the core and we wanted to be like the core like brand, and we didn't want to let that audience down. And like,
well, absolutely. I remember even Kyle working in the bedroom office back in the house and going over some of the script stuff that I had started to write with you guys. And I remember you got really upset.
I was
and
a little too
like,
emotional
is...
back then or too
yeah, well, no,
passionate.
No, it's all good things, man, because that passion translated into a lot of really awesome stuff.
But a lot better than being apathetic about
absolutely,
the situation.
Absolutely, for sure. But I remember you were really upset about something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember the conversation went on and be like, well, you know what? Like, we can make this work. And here, like, the song that we're using for Henrik, this is one of the grimiest tracks we've used in a while. And this is offsetting this. And this is like, you know, there is a balance, and we could figure out a way to get this 85-year-old man's voice into this movie.
Well, certainly
with Henrik.
The movie was not compromised to accommodate him.
No.
It was not like, oh, we'll make this a little more like PG. Warren Miller-y. Yeah, PG,
In fact, I remember that conversation about some of the music. It was like, we're like borderline intentionally going to use it to offset the direction with Warren and you know, create this balance where we're going to be as true as we can to our vibe and what we represent, and just kind of interject, you know, some words of wisdom from Warren.
Sweet. Tom, once we get past all the, like, the gritty details of how this kind of goes south that we're going to get into after the fact, I hear you had a bit of a statement to make at the Salt Lake City premiere that year.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I forget. So after it all goes like south, and then obviously WME and like the old parent company is getting bummed at Josh and the whole crew. I forget what happened, but there was a Warren Miller Entertainment movie premiere in Salt Lake that I ended up at with a shirt on that had a little character pissing on WME, getting into
I think it said fuck WME on
it. Might have. And we were protesting. We actually had picket signs.
That was legit.
Picket lines, yep, straight up.
At some point, somebody, like one of the other athletes, like I forget who, in the Warren Miller movie, came out to like yell at me and tell me like I didn't really know what I was talking about. They're like, are you even like, do you even know Josh? Are you even close like to this? And I was like, yeah, I was at his wedding last week. Like, what do you mean? And just burned this girl. It was pretty funny.
And I'm Tom Walsh. I got the fucking opener in that movie.
I don't think she knew who I was. That's for sure.
It's
not.
Funny in hindsight.
Now she does.
And I don't want to get into it too much. I know we were all very emotional about it in the past, but it's so funny that if they just had embraced it and just come together, it would have been a positive thing for it would have just been good for everyone. It's like,
oh, it would have been wonderful. It would have been such good vibes all the way around.
Instead, it was just so absurd.
Instead, we had lawyers at our premieres, like, taking notes and that. I'm sure Joshua will get deep into that towards the end of the podcast.
Kyle, I remember, we'll get into all this later, all the backlash, but Kyle, I remember driving back with you from IF3 that year. I think we had I had flown into Cleveland, and we had driven up together from Ohio.
Wow.
But, yeah, that year. We were driving back to – I don't know why we did that, but we did. We're driving back to Ohio from Montreal, and, you know, it was at night, and we're still riding this high from playing the movie for the first couple times, but – there was this dark doom and gloom about this lawsuit that had just been filed. And I think Joshua had just hit us with the deets that, like, Level One is being sued. And it felt so heavy, that particular drive. And I think Kyle and I were driving for, like, you know, 5 or 6 hours in the night talking about this. And it felt like, it was like, are we going to, like, be out of business? And that was like the first thing that came to my mind. I was like, do we no longer have like jobs? Like, what's it was like, it felt like the end of the world or something in a way. Cause I had never ever in my, you know, imagined being like threatened by this corporate lawsuit from this, what felt like a massive, you know, David and Goliath situation. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it was.
But you know, and then, you know, the next day it all, you know, the sky's cleared and it was like, oh, this is going to be fine. But it was just that initial. It's going to be fun. Yeah. I mean, we ended up having some fun with it, but that initial drive, God, I remember just very well, you and I discussing it, and it was depressing,
but
for a few hours.
I think you just put it best. Like I forgot, you know, not even mention it like that. It was like a high, like, back in the day, going to those IF3s, especially Refresh was one that we were just so damn proud of. And it was just like so exciting to just show it to people. And all the athletes were there. That was back when there was this massive festival. And it was like, that was B-Dog's big coming out. And he was like a hometown hero. I mean, there was just There was so much energy. So,
was IF3 the third screening that year? Because Denver was Saturday and Boulder was the next, I want to say, Thursday. So I feel like IF3 might have been that next weekend or something like that. Because you were all, of course, with us in Boulder.
Yeah, I believe it was, it must have been Denver, Boulder, and then immediately IF3. Yeah. So the order of things was like...
Maybe even like a Wednesday.
Premiere the movie in Denver, and then Wednesday, they Boulder. Find out about Warren, and then they file that like, whatever, cease and desist to stop premiering the movie. And then after IF3, it's like full-blown lawsuit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the vibes started to get real awkward at the Boulder premiere, because that's when we knew there were like... potentially lawyers there, and that's when we were like, it was just a weird vibe because it was so exciting in Denver, and then I feel like Boulder, there was just like, what's gonna happen? Like, it was weird.
Yeah, there was like an impending attack.
Oh, it was not impending; it was like full on attack mode. But I want to make the most of your time, Kyle, and your time, Wally, so we can kind of skip around a little bit.
Yeah, I'm curious, when was the premiere for the Joss edit?
Oh, so that was actually in the whole in Joss the season, thing went down in the middle of the season in Sweden. Like, that was a 2-week marathon of filming during the day and the night, and then editing from 3 a.m. to 8 a.m., and then sleeping a little bit, and then shooting some more, and then playing that edit at the end of those couple weeks.
What was that like, fitting that into the schedule of the season for both of you guys? Was that gnarly, taking 2 weeks out to go film this one-off thing?
Yeah.
Well, that was an honor, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at the time, I thought it was a huge honor. I was so hyped. It was just like, man, this is going to be great. Like, a little bit of the backstory there is that Riley Poore and Simon Dumont had been hit up by Jon Olsen, who ran... the Jon Olsen Super Sessions.
I think
event.
We should make it clear. We're talking about this Jon Olsen Invitational that happened every spring in Aura, Sweden.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
So for those who don't know what Joss is.
For sure. Jon Olsen and Super every, Sessions.
And he basically K-O-S-S. Gathered the best of, like, the who's who to come to absolutely. Sweden, yep. party their and then, dicks off.
party like crazy and work real hard producing free content for Jon. But in this case, Riley Poore had hit me up in the fall after Turbo had come out and said, hey, man, like, Jon wants us back. We're going to do this like team thing where we need another filmer and another athlete. And we want you and Tanner Rainville to come do this. And I was like, fuck, yeah, this is going to be awesome. But this is really like a park centric thing. I got a trick on my sleeve. His name is Tom Walsh. And it being a park-based thing, like, that's really what you want. And, of course, this is after Rainville's opening part in Turbo, so he was, like, cream of the crop, like, no doubt. But as far as, like, his interest and his focus moving forward were definitely going towards the backcountry.
And he had popped his shoulder out.
Yeah, and he had a trick shoulder at that point. Yeah, that would fall out when he was sleeping at night.
Nice.
Yeah, it was kind of bad. Ouch. But regardless, it was like, Tom Walsh is our secret weapon. We're going to bring this dude. He's on the next level. It's going to be a lot of fun. And Riley was like, game on. Let's do this. Of course, a month and a half into the season, Riley was involved in a very tragic accident where he broke his neck and since had to step away from his role as a filmer. And so Tyler from Poor Boys subbed in for him. And so it became the four of us, myself and Tyler filming. Nate Abbott was the still photographer who was part of our team. And then, of course, Simon Dumont and Tom Walsh. And we spent 2 weeks making what I feel was far and away the strongest and most entertaining and rad edit of that whole thing. Quite an experience, though, huh, Tom?
Yeah, no, that was absurd. I mean, even when, like, I guess maybe you had heard about the video contest and, like, the whole idea of Joss becoming, like, a video contest before me, I only heard when Simon like eventually asked me like in person at some event, and I was like, wait, this dude, this X Games gold medal dude wants me to be in a video with him and me and Berm are gonna shoot it? Okay, I'm down with this. And it was like, it was such a unique idea at the time. Like, the event had always been a big air, but for the competition to start being a video competition and like actually be prize money, it was like probably the first real video competition that offered money for like in skiing. It was like
$20,000.
Really, like, yeah, like that was cool. Like going from just big airs and slope styles to like, this is gonna be video. Like, oh, we're gonna win this shit. Like, this is what we do. And yeah, that 2 weeks was so fun. I mean, like, the latest night, the hardest work. We're probably one of the only crews, or maybe one of two crews, shooting urban in videos. Like, everybody else was, like, doing the big jumps. And we were, like, getting down and dirty at night, like, finding generators, borrowing, like, these terrible, terrible lights to, like, light up wall rides and stalls. And it was so fun, though, like, putting that together and then getting, like, crazy good feedback. I know we ended up releasing the video a bit earlier because we were a little ornery that we didn't do too well, but the feedback was just straight through the roof and people were so fired up. It was so cool.
Well, that was a bizarre thing because Yoon had, he used to be best friends with Simon in years prior to this event. And then their like friendship had gone sour and it turned into this crazy vendetta situation where
two mega egos would have guessed.
Could not fit in Sweden at the same time. And it was really bizarre because Yoon, I remember we had like a meeting at the front end where, you know, we talked about the judging criteria and how the whole thing would be put together. And that's where they talked about urban and you and I looked at each other, Tom, and nodded. We're like, fuck yeah, got this in the bag. And so we did. But then Yoon went and changed the rules several times throughout the contest. And ultimately, we ended up not winning.
Sounds like real ski.
who won that year?
Team Norway.
The Field Production Suits. And props to them. They put together an awesome edit.
I just do not remember that video. I remember your video, and I remember my friend is a pro.
Yeah. That was the next year?
Mike Thomas.
That was that year. That was the first year.
Was it that year?
Yeah. It was
that
year.
Okay. Well, anyway. Okay, that's right. It was that year. But anyway, the Team Norway dudes, the Field Productions guys put together a great video for sure. But we definitely felt like straight up jilted by the whole process because of all these weird rule changes and these things that we were hearing around, I don't know, like through the grapevine. And then I'll never forget, I took a bus from Aura to wherever the airport was with JF Kusan, like a couple days after the whole event wrapped up. And he had been one of the judges. And he's like, man, like, I don't know what you guys did to Yoon, why he hates you so much. He came into the judges' room and said, Simon's team cannot and will not win. I don't fucking care what you have to do. That edit is not going to win.
Shots motherfucking fired right there.
Yeah. And it was like,
I don't remember.
Oh, my
That's
God.
Crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I'd known Jeff for a while, but not that closely. And certainly not well enough that he had any real reason to tell me beyond just wanting to, like, put the truth out there. But it was crazy. And also, there's this weird thing where Yoon wanted us to pay, like, $5,000 to license the song so he could put it out through his channels and monetize it. And it was like, fuck no, dude. Like, that's... we're not doing that. Like, that was just crazy.
Yeah. Who came up with the Jesus concept?
I don't know who came up with that.
Because, I mean, you guys went all in it.
Oh, we did. So we did. Well, you know,
it'd be awkward if it was Tom.
Tom's like, guys, I got this great idea.
I think it might have been Berman.
I think I did, actually. Yeah. And I remember very specifically that Simon had done an edit with Riley the year before that had an intro in that church in Aura.
Yeah, that's
and
what,
I wanted to do something that was in some way a tribute
self-referential.
Tribute to and inspired by what Riley had done, just to really, I don't know, like do something that would mean something to him because we were all there because of Riley Poor and you know, his injury was like a very fresh thing and certainly everybody's
tragic.
Mind.
Yeah.
And the Jesus thing is just a reference to the original Super Unknown video that, like, when I made my Super Unknown video, it leaked before Level One could release all the videos, and it leaked onto YouTube with the title, What Jesus Would Look Like If He Freestyle Skied.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the title of the video, and it got, like, 500,000 views at the beginning of YouTube, and it was like... the title eventually maybe changed, but for a while, the Jesus thing was just a joke because of some random kid decided to label it that, which was like the highest praise you could get. But we like always played off that joke in some way.
Oh, yeah.
I knew it was referencing something.
That's right. So that is where
that's
that
a crucial bridge of information there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would not have known that. Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. But the edit starts the exact same way, like word for word, almost shot for shot with what Riley had done the year before. And then all of a sudden there's like the record scratch and Simon looks up and is like, Jesus, is that you? No, it's me, Tom Wallish.
I tell you what, that white robe almost was a good kit. The tall tees were so big in the day, that white robe almost played as an outfit.
Dude, that was a sheet from the hotel. And I remember I had this crazy filter that was called like Auto Shine or something that like did God's rays. And I was like, oh my God, this is fucking perfect. Like, it really looks like Jesus incarnate.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously the afterbang exit with me riding a skateboard hidden under the sheet being pulled by someone so I can afterbang my way out of the church.
Tyler was pulling the skateboard on a rope. And we just had you just like glide through the church, like a 1,000-year-old church.
That might have been the most arrogant scene I've ever acted in.
It's got to be up there.
Absolutely.
It's got to be up there.
In all the best ways, though.
Yeah. And it's very tongue-in-cheek. It's like, obviously.
Well, it only works because Dumont's the one who's, like, saying the other side of it. Who's just as much of an OG. Like, that's why it's not heinously egoic. Should we talk about the movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to hear what everybody's favorite segments from this movie are. Let's start with you two, Kyle and Tom. You got a favorite from this flick?
I honestly don't. I mean, I would probably just reference all the segments. My favorite were like the DeLorme, Wallace, Casabana, Matt Hornback, like basically
New Era.
Like those guys. I mean, there's so many strong segments. I can't point at one. If I were, I would say Wallace's opener was like
pretty
insane.
You.
And then there's also like he also watching the movie again, like he's got a Finland segment, and then there's another, he's like in, he's, you've got like several segments.
And Mammoth,
I think for me the Mammoth segment, like I remember even when we first watched it to that track, I was like, oh man, like where's the hip-hop on this track, because there's like so much good hip-hop on the rest of the movie. But then just remembering the session and the vibes with that song, like, and there's way more than just the like Mammoth jump. I always forget about the massive step down and the tree taps and the rails. And it was like such a slaughter fest of like different people. And it just like has a better vibe than I remember. Like that one stood out to me rewatching it. The like my seg Sick. Is probably one of the ones I'm most proud of that I've ever had in a Level 1 movie. But like rewatching it, like I don't need to watch myself. Like when I skip to something, I skip to DeLorme. Or that Mammoth seg, or even like Wiley, I feel like got slept on a little in that one. Like
that was so
even
good.
We
too.
Had the closing part,
dude. Yeah. There's so much fire in there. The like rocker gap clips and the like all Rocker's the Utah gap. Jumps. Like
There's kids in Utah, like the kids that are out going out in the backcountry now. Certainly younger than Wiley. He's like this like reference of like, oh, Wiley hit this jump. I feel like. Wiley's hit every Utah, and that was his big year in Utah. I don't think Rocker Gap's really been hit too much since or
no,
at all.
No way.
For a good reason. It's a sketchy ass jump.
It's kind of just like an iconic jump where like it's like a novelty.
Yeah, it almost is. But that, I mean, that was like, I remember being at the time being, obviously Rocker's Gap was a huge get or whatever, but at the time of making the movie, I was very proud of Wiley's part and like all that it accomplished. But I still love it. But Casabon's part, in my opinion, is it's probably one of my favorite parts of all time in the Level 1 movie.
Yeah, it's real good. There's so much good stuff in there.
I wonder whatever happened to him,
dude. And like that segment. I mean, there's some segments in that movie that could be released today and would still turn heads. It's just like,
I think a lot of that.
It's pretty crazy to think that, say your favorite segment in this movie in 2009 is Phil's, and in 2019, Phil won X Games Real Ski Gold. Still, 10 years later.
You know what's for the second year in a row.
But I mean, Wallace, your shit gives me chills when it, like, it starts up, though.
So a couple things real quick. Yeah. I'd point out that the list of riders that we had in this movie, the vast majority of them are still very, very relevant today, which is crazy. Because that was 10 years ago.
Almost everybody.
And yeah. I feel like I've said this many times referencing the movie is I still look back and I feel like I didn't even know how much I appreciated that group. Like, looking back, you're like, holy shit. Because everyone's kind of, you know, gone separate ways or do different things. And, like, what an insane. It's almost like it was too good of a lineup to have in one movie. Yeah.
Dude, it was a straight up murder.
Two movies. Yeah. Like,
Murderer's Row.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not to say we took it for granted because that's not the case, but you cannot realize until a little bit of time passes how impactful all that stuff is.
That's the
nature of it. That's how it works.
Yeah. At the time, though, there was definitely some awareness of, like, how much fire had gone down. I specifically remember Kyle editing, New Era, which was, like, the secondary movie, accoutrement to Refresh, which is, like, Kyle's a beast mode editor, and he was, like, making these parts very quickly while we were at this house in Mount Hood, waiting out weather to shoot that jump. But it was just like all evening and night, we're huddled around that laptop watching shots, and you were putting together B-Dog, Wallish, Ahmet, Delorme, Hornbeck. And it was so,
there was such a good energy in there.
Yeah. It was like,
there's a photo somewhere of everyone huddled around that computer, and that was like, certainly probably one of the best, like, editing moments, because everyone hadn't seen everyone else's stuff, and you're like, so it's just like you're editing, and behind you there's like everyone's like, your segment's the best, no, you got the best. It was just like everyone was just like freaking out. It's like the best skiers, but also the fans of, like, everyone's each other's biggest fan.
Absolutely.
Pretty awesome.
And you almost like one up the movie in a lot of ways with those segments, because I was like, damn, like, I remember being like, we have to, like, re-edit these for the movie now. Like, this is, like, some of the illest parts ever made. But it was the stepping stone for making the movie, I think.
Absolutely. 100%.
Probably would have been a little bit harder to get rights to Tupac and Akon and everything else that's in there.
Akon, man, that sets a
that's a different track.
Sure. Looking back, I don't even think it was, like, a plan to make a... I guess I always made, like, DVD bonus features, but I feel like maybe we just started looking at footage and they were like, let's see what it looks like to this track, and then it, like, led to, I still, like, look back and, like, that's one of, that year is, like, I don't think that it's just, like, one of the most special years. That's, like, I'd say one of the most special years in working in skiing,
I feel.
One
of the most essential trips that I feel like we got to hit on is the Logan trip we all did, because it was Hornbeck and Phil.
I was going to bring that up right now.
And it was pretty cool to be back on a trip. We were street this time, but me, Hornbeck, and Phil all on a trip together again. And 10 years ago, probably our first, like, real backcountry foray into, like, weeks of sledding and jump building. And it's just so funny having that crew together, like, non-backcountry skiers.
Yeah,
was me, Hornbeck, and
there was
Cassavon.
A lot of cotton being worn on that trip. Frozen tall tees hanging out.
And Wallace had a pair of park skis, because I think he'd experimented with, like, pow skis. And he's like, I know exactly where I am in the air with park skis. And, like, I'll just figure out how to land them in the pile, because I got the tricks in the air, but I put these other skis on, it throws me off. So I think you guys are all mostly had some, except B-Dog had some nice big armadas.
Yeah, that was such a fun trip. I remember we had maybe 3 sleds for 5 people, so not terrible, a decent number of sleds
to
get
fine.
Out there.
It's as long as you don't have an inverted curve there, where there are more, like, twice as many, more than twice as many as sleds.
Yeah.
But man,
somebody was being towed out. There's a night shot that looks really cool, but now looking back, you're like, there's a guy in cotton towing behind a snowmobile with cold gloves at the end
towing.
Of a long day.
Oh, that one day, that was the day where it was nuking so hard that we could barely see, and you'd set up a dolly for this, like, jump through the trees where Cassavon does a first hit, flat 3, nose tap on the tree branch to just, like, stomp. And that was the only thing we got on that jump all day.
He almost got a dub on that jump.
Did he?
Yeah.
Which was insanely dirty, but Hornbeck got a big old Cork 7.
Okay, that's right, he did. He did. But that day it just started snowing harder and harder and harder. I remember by the time we left, yeah, it was pitch black dark, towing people out through a full-on blizzard, just like soaked to the bone and frozen solid too.
Oh, yeah. We all learned a lot about technical ski gear. I think we've come a long way in like what you wear in the backcountry.
Just like the level of getting out there sledding too. It's like tow 10 miles, then the hill climb's too steep to double. So
to get a hike.
Phil and Tom, why don't you guys just boot pack up this like 200 yard steep hill and we'll sled up. A couple of us will crash on the way up. Once we eventually get up there,
at least once.
We'll double to the jump. I mean, like, I spent a lot of time in that same Logan zone this year building jumps, and like, just every time I go up like a couple of the different hill climbs on my sled now, I'm like, God, we were like, so it was so loose and reckless getting around this area.
That snowstorm, I now remember, I had left because we had like dollies and stuff. I was like, I'm gonna leave some gear up here, we're gonna be up here tomorrow, and
buried
it was buried, and there's still a tripod somewhere up there. I always wanted to go up in that summer and go camping. I know exactly where it is, and I think it's too close to a campsite, but it's kind of funny.
This is also like peak gibberish and stuff like that. Connor was going through some of the behind the scenes from Refresh the other day, and like there's so much, like Hornbeck's laying out kits. And like on the floor, I mean, this is in Michigan, but yeah. Same. He's wearing the same kit at the Utah as well. Like that crew neck with the orange jacket, like blue and orange. And you guys are stunting so hard with that stuff up there. Like, dude, you're like, I think Wallace, you and Hornbeck are like straight up like doing like, you know, wipes and dusting off each other's logos.
See a lot of that.
It's like
there's a lot of birds, a lot of like flapping the arms birds. And like brushing off like boots, and oh my God.
Yeah, so, brushing off boots, that's what it is.
So a couple things real quick. Just on that Logan trip, man, it's pretty funny watching some of that content because that is his own. Like you, Wally, we also went back to some of that stuff this year.
Yeah.
And I know Friedel came away with a bunch of shots on some of the same hits that were featured.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, we 10 years later revisited the perfect jump or whatever. It's the jump that Wallace gets switch five first hit.
I'm at Rodeo Fives or no?
There's two Cork Seven.
Two different jumps.
Yeah.
It was kind of a cool I don't know, full circle.
Absolutely. Also, the last day of that trip was one of the more memorable filming days of the year for me, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And to jog your memory, and you guys feel free to jump in at any point here, but somebody's sled had died. I want to say Hornbeck's sled had died. So the day started out with us getting up long pre-dawn. We're talking like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock wake-up call, something like that from the motel in Logan. Gearing up, and the whole idea was we're going to go up there. I think we had like one or two things we wanted to shoot, and then we're going to rescue the sled. But we were such a junk show getting people back there and trying to like figure out how to either get the sled going or even like hook it up that we never ended up shooting anything back there. And that took the better part of the day. And by the time we were like kind of, I don't know, like had our shit together, it was like, all right, we don't have any time to even shoot. It's going to get dark sooner than later. We just got to get the fuck out of here. So we did that, went back to Logan, and then we ended up shooting that parking garage rail with Phil and Hornbeck. And that went into the, I don't know, like pretty much last light. I remember, Wally, you also messed around on this wall ride. We're trying to do rodeos onto a wall ride, which didn't quite work out. But,
really? Never seen those shots.
Or what, rodeo off. Yeah. Like sort of flip off of it, maybe.
Yeah. One or the other, but did not work. But anyway, so Phil and Rekha ended up with a couple shots on that parking garage feature. And then it's like, all right, well, let's get out of here. Let's pack up. And you mentioned, I think we like hit up some sort of fast food joint for a quick snack. And then you're like, oh man, like I really want to go take a look at that
Kanye
Quad King down in Ogden. Let's go look at it. And I remember, like, I was beat. We roll into there, and it was definitely dark out. I mean, call it, like, 7, 8 o'clock at night, something like that. We roll in, and it is completely buried under multiple feet of wet snow. As soon as I open my car door to get out and look at it, it starts raining. I close my car door, just like, fuck this. And then you come up to the window or the door. I roll my window down. You're like, let's do it. I'm just like, okay, gonna rally, gonna make this happen. Okay. And like against my better judgment and common sense, we started a multi-hour shovel project to unbury this thing. Again, from like the wettest, heaviest slop snow. And that session ended up going into all hours of the night. I think that Hornbeck like looked at the rail and was just like, I'm going to sleep. Yo, see you later. So he like curled up in Decker's car.
Yep.
And then, yeah.
He came out as a big hype man though.
Yep.
Yeah. And yep. You and Phil went off on that thing for a while. I know Phil got tail press, nose press, a couple different variations.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say early on, but earlier on, we're talking like maybe, you know, midnight-ish or one.
A more reasonable hour.
Slightly more reasonable hour, you would say. And mm-hmm. just pissing rain. I remember being so wet, like as wet as you could possibly be, to the point where like if you jumped in a pool, you wouldn't be any wetter because you were like so, like all the layers were completely soaked through, just like my socks were wet, and like tops of my socks and my boots were wet from like water seeping through my shoulders, like that kind of scenario. And I couldn't really see straight. I was going handheld, standing on top of the sled trailer in the parking lot, and Decker was on the dolly move.
Yeah.
And I just remember like, man, like I gotta get this. Like if Wallace gets the shot, like I can't fucking blow it. Like I can't really see very straight right now.
That gets scary as a filmer when it's too deep in a session and your bones are starting to get weary and still trying to replicate like the perfect shot that you probably started out filming, especially when you're handheld and stuff.
Oh yeah. Not to mention like number of tries. Like we're talking probably 150 plus tries. Yes.
Right, where you're just going through the motions.
Straight up. Right,
like muscle memory.
You're brain dead because you're...
Brain dead.
Yep.
Because you're numb to the newness of it.
Yeah. I remember thinking like, man, I'm so jealous of Decker on the dolly because he just has to push it. even if he falls asleep right now...
He's still getting the shot.
He's still getting the shot. It's like, oh man, can't fuck this up. And I remember when you finally got it, like... 2 or 3 in the morning, whatever it was, somehow I'm not going to say I blew a couple prior shots because I definitely because
I never blow shots.
Let me know when and if you find one.
Filmers do blow attempts sometimes, but as long as you don't blow the real one.
Exactly. Yeah. But like I definitely got the shots, but there was like a very perfect, there's a very specific zoom and like motion that I was looking for.
Uh-huh.
And then he just laced it. And I remember thinking, oh my fucking God, how did I actually get that and not blow it? Because like, I can't even, I'm going to fall over, like straight up, like instantly this crazy adrenaline rush, probably comparable to what Wally was feeling, like goes through my body and it's just like, fuck yeah. And I remember we were so hyped. We spent like another 45 minutes shooting cutaways.
Lifestyles.
Oh my God. Like, hey Wally, we need like 10 different angles of you hiking up the stairs. Cool, I got it. No big deal.
I mean, you can tell the energy. I feel like I need to watch it again, but Wallace's opening shot, I think, was shot after the fact.
Yeah, opens the movie.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, opening, for those of you that don't know the Gagne Quad, that is the opening shot of the movie. And, yeah, that was one of the more special.
I don't know if you guys remember, too, but I, like, kind of got it to switch, but not that good. Like, earlier, like at like 12, and we were just shit talking like that's not good enough, watching the shot like mm-mm. that would make it in another movie, like maybe that'd make it in a TGR movie, that's not gonna make it in a level one movie, let's go for more.
I think you actually went on a rant about poor boys at the time.
And then it wasn't good enough, but like the one we got was so good, like from the shot to the style, but dude, it was
everything
so
was
long
flawless. And I will also mention the fact that earlier in that season, it might have even been like sometime in December, I remember being in my kitchen in Denver and you called me up, you're like, yo, like I think you went and tried that with AJ and didn't get it, is that right?
I don't think so. Or maybe.
I swear to God, you called me and you were like, either that you were on your way to do it or you tried it and didn't get it. But there's something where you had set the stage for that this being like this particular goal that you wanted. And yeah. I was like, oh, you're going to get it. Like, we're going to do this. And so, like, there were months where I had this in the back of my mind. Like, this is something that Walsh wants to do.
Set the intention.
We are going to get it at some point. And this was just like, for me as a filmer, like crossing it off my to-do list because it was like a goal that you had helped me set. And I remember.
I think we had just posted
the photo on Instagram like yesterday or whatever for the Turbo. And I was like, I don't even remember Tom hitting it in Turbo.
Yeah.
And then I watched that part again. It's like, oh, yeah.
Just the late swap.
I hit it every year for like 4 years. We hit it in the first 4x9 movie. We hit it in Turbo. Me and Kyle shot it in Turbo at Last Light.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, we shot it, obviously, in Refresh. Did you guys hear that it's gone? They tore it down.
Torn down.
Also, we would be remiss to not talk about the fact that we all call it the Gagné quad. Because
absolutely.
Charles Gagné was the first one to slide it, I guess. But, like, it's just stuck. And it's such a hard name to pronounce or to spell. Like,
I think it's...
Why did we choose such a tough name?
I think it was the Gagné quad because, like, he did that rail way before people had any business hitting
a rail of that size.
And it was so unbelievable. And I think he got super broke off doing it. So just out of respect for him.
True.
Kind of paving
Well, oftentimes things are named for the first person.
He did that in 2003 or 2004 probably.
Yeah. To wrap up that story, though, I remember not being able to really see straight on the drive from Ogden back to Salt Lake, and I was staying or crashing at Wiley's place. And I remember getting there at whatever ungodly time, and I was like equal parts wired and like fired up and like scary, dead. Just like fatigue. Dead. Because really, we had been awake and like out getting after it for over 24 hours straight, which is a long day. And I remember, like, against my better judgment, I like pulled my camera out. It's like, I've got to watch this. Gotta watch this now. And for reasons that we've talked about in the past, like, it's not a great idea to go and like rewatch something. But I was like,
it was on memory cards.
No. That was.
No, I was just about to say.
EX1.
It's the first year of slow motion for level one, I think. The EX1, we all got
Turbo
EX1.
Was.
Did we shoot slow motion? Yeah.
Yeah.
That rail is shot in slow motion on the Sony EX1.
Yeah.
Which you had was brought into service. It was deployed, so to speak, at the mid 2008, and by 2009 we were all on EX1s.
Yeah,
which
Berman got it ahead of time.
To this day, my favorite camera, but it shot on memory cards, which scared the living shit out of me. You delete the master after you put it. What is that? Because you never deleted a tape.
Yeah. No. Okay. Well, I guess I got that point wrong, but I do remember like sitting there watching it and just being like, gotta watch this again.
I bet in your mind it was so baked in that you shouldn't be watching it.
Probably, man. Like, probably at that point, 10 years of precedence, like you can't watch,
right.
Shouldn't, don't do it. But I also remember just like, is this as sick as I think it is? It's like, yes, I think this is as sick as I think it is. And like, yeah, man, definitely a standout moment.
Yeah.
Dude, it's so sick, it doesn't even seem real. Like, I watch that now, and it's like the pouring rain, the middle of the night, the trick, the rail itself. Like,
we would
everything.
Not be doing that now.
Yeah. I don't know. I might do it now. That was fun.
Especially if it's like a number one priority.
You know, I'd probably do it if Walsh knocked on my car door. I was like, we're doing it.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And take some B12.
That same trip is the hilarious story of you guys betting me that if I went after the trip and won the Dew Tour, I'd have to buy a snowmobile.
That's right.
And when I did win the Dew Tour, I got held to it, which I really needed that money for other important credit card debt and other things. But obviously, I bought a snowmobile.
Betting man.
And became somewhat of a backcountry skier, but not really.
That was your first big competition to win. And I remember.
Exactly.
I don't think any of us were there, but everyone were watching remotely or hearing. And back, you were like this. You know, the skiers, you know, skiers' choice. Or like, we were just at the whole, I feel like there's a whole industry rooting for you. Like, finally, the boy, like, the dude made it.
Oh, I have like, we put so much emphasis on that because it was like, yeah, definitely a team rooting situation. But at that time in the year, Dude Tour had three stops, and it was before they cut it down to just one. It was an actual tour. There was, the first one was at Breckenridge. The second one was at Mount Snow. Is that correct?
Yep.
And the third one was at Snow Basin, Utah. So you broke your collarbone.
Or no, it was in North Star, Tahoe that year. But then it started, the third started being in Snow Basin after that.
Oh, so you won the one in North Star.
North Star,
okay.
The first year.
Okay. So I remember in December, '08, Breckenridge.
Yep.
I was up there with you and Henrik, and you broke your collarbone. And then what happened in Mount Snow?
Mount Snow, I just didn't get invited to slopestyle. Tanner, like Hall, tried to give me his spot, but they wouldn't let him. But I had a pipe invite, so I competed in half pipe at the Dude Tour and got 23rd place, not last. So
I just remember being this sense of urgency for some reason. It was like he has to win one of these Dude Tours because it's the golden ticket. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory gets you into like X Games, and it'll get you like a paycheck that will then like that'll just be the launching pad.
Yeah.
And it freaking was. It really was.
In every way. Well, I mean, those contests were. They were the centerpiece.
It was like you saved the best for last. You won North Star. And then immediately, I think you went on that trip with us to Quebec. But it was like, you're in now. You did it. Like, Walsh won. Dude Tour.
Oh, so sick.
Has arrived.
The boy has arrived. The boy made it big. Ma.
So funny.
Yeah. Decker, I want to talk about that trip to Michigan.
I was going to bring up exactly that. Yeah, I was just watching some of this old stuff where, like, you guys hanging out in the house with Henrik when he's just, like,
Henrik
an
steals
insanely
the show
young.
On that.
Oh,
he
my
steals
God.
The show on that trip, not because of it, like, I mean, because of everything. I don't want to take anything away from Hornbeck and Amet because they crushed that trip, but that was so unique. That was Henrik's first street trip. He was super young, I think.
Yep.
And he was out to prove, and he was like, he was super unknown style hungry. He was like,
but he was not originally there.
No, Friedel,
yeah,
you want to,
that's, wanna,
that's the best
right.
lead in right there is Friedel
well,
can take it.
Yeah. So you were in the Midwest and you went as the first snowfall. I think you probably went to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where your friend Hunter had a house to stay at. So it was you, Hornbeck, and Met filming early. I mean, like first week in December, December 1st, 2nd, 3rd, something like that. You know, first trip of the year style. And what happened? Your camera broke?
Yeah, I was shooting.
First
there was
rail.
Like a down flat angle kind of rail. And I think my camera got too wet and something like fried. So
yes.
I'm on this like trip with these like
that'll happen.
All star, you know, Hornbeck and Amet were on one. And
dude,
I don't
for
have a
one,
camera.
You problem solved. You MacGyvered that shit and set up some sort of screen.
I used a screen from my video
your
transmitter
boom.
For the
cable cam.
For the cable cam. So it was like sort of worked, but
not ideal.
Yeah.
But you made it happen. So props for fixing that problem on the fly.
But
it wasn't a permanent solution.
I think you called Berman in great urgency. And Berman's was like, well, we have another extra EX1. We can bring, you know, we could ship it there, which will take overnight at best, but probably longer than that because it's, I think, maybe even a weekend.
I think so.
Or, you know, Friedel or somebody could fly to Michigan ASAP, deliver a camera. And it was like, it might as well be another filmer. So I was up at Breckenridge at the time. I think I was still, I had made a gibberish edit of my own that fall.
Yeah.
But I was still filming for like some just whatever early park stuff. I was up there. Henrik was up there. And I think it was right around that getting ready for that Dude Tour or whatever. But, I just got a call from Josh midday, like on the chairlift at Keystone or Breck or whatever. And it was, he's like, do you want to, go to Detroit, Michigan, like immediately? Because Kyle's camera just broke and it only makes sense if somebody just flies there right now. Cause I looked at tickets. They're super cheap. There's a flight out of DIA tonight at 8 PM. You can get into Detroit at midnight and then whatever. And I was like, okay.
Like, if that's that is exactly what I was going to do. Well, when I got
it just was
morning.
Like so like strange and just like, yeah. And Henrik was with me, and I don't know the order or who asked who, but we watched the interview, and it made it sound like Henrik was like, yo, can I come though?
That's how he explained it. Yep.
Which is probably true. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, Henrik, is it cool if Henrik comes?
I remember calling you, actually, and there's a funny shot. It's hysterical. You guys shot that moment where you're on the phone, holding the phone up. I'm like, yo, can Henrik come? And there's like a moment of hesitation. You're just like...
You asked, I think you wanted to make sure it was cool with Hornbeck and Amet. And they're like, sure,
probably
he can come. And we raced to Tom Warnick's house to grab Henrik's stuff. And then,
which was like a t-shirt and sweatpants.
Dude, it was nothing. For real, though, that's pretty much what he had. And then, so Henrik was 15 or 16, but, I mean, young. And then raced down. I just remember being, like, in I-70 traffic, being like, oh, I got to get to the house so I can pack up because this flight leaves in, like, 3 hours or whatever. And I was like, oh, you know, all of a sudden life comes at you really fast. But it was exciting for sure because, yeah, I had Henrik in tow, and, you know, this was the first trip of the year.
This is the same trip where Henrik didn't have a passport anymore and flew with just an Aura ski pass as his only form of identification.
Do you remember why he didn't have a passport?
I don't know.
He left it in his ski pants, I think.
Yeah.
Something weird.
I think so we went straight from the ski hill to the Warnick's house to grab his stuff, and he definitely left something behind.
Something,
I mean, it was
very
much like...
It ended up getting shipped to him later.
It existed, but he didn't lose it altogether. It existed somewhere in Colorado.
I mean, between the phone call and us checking in for the flight in Denver International Airport, it was like 4 hours had passed, and that included driving from Summit County and then me getting the camera gear and all that. So I show up to security with Henrik, and he's like, I don't have my passport, though. And I was like... Well, that's a huge fucking problem.
But I have a ski pass.
Yeah, so we go up to, the security.
Is he wearing ski clothes in the airport?
He may have been.
Probably.
He may have been wearing, he was definitely wearing, yeah, I think he was wearing ski clothes.
Epic.
And he was so young and at that time, like, quite Swedish still. Like, he didn't have, like, a super, like, a, you know, eloquent grasp on English by any means, but he was just kind of like, I was like, what do you have for an ID? Do you have like a, I mean, he had a credit card or something, but I was like, do you have anything that has your face and name on it at the same place? And he's like, I have my ski pass from Aura. I was like, fucking Hail Mary this shit. Go up to the security. And I think it helped that he was a minor because they were basically like,
little boy, do you know this strange man who's taking you to Detroit?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I think they kind of thought he was his guardian. Because they were like, this is definitely a problem, but since he's underage, there was some exemption. And he showed them the ski pass and it's like, yeah, like it's definitely you, kid. And he's like, eh. But I think that they were like, man, I think they felt bad for him. And he was so young and confused that it was just like, you know what? Like, and they're like, you accept responsibility for him. And I was like, yes, you know, and I think we're explaining what to do. And they were confused and felt sorry for him. And for whatever reason, I don't know if it was we just slipped through the cracks there, but we got on that flight, showed up
so
to Detroit.
Crazy.
Yeah, showed up to Detroit at midnight and rented a Chevy Cobalt, and we drove through the night to Grand Rapids and met up with those dudes. I think went to sleep at 3 or 4 in the morning and woke up in Michigan. The rest is history.
Sure is.
Yeah,
sure is. So funny.
Kyle, I something really cool watching this footage now and understanding a little bit more is that you're playing around a lot with lav mics, right? What was it like shooting with that? Well, for you and for the writers, Tom.
I don't know why. I think as a filmmaker, you were just trying to like
get
some kind of an edge on something, and you just get excited. And also standing in
new toys
in a parking lot forever, you get bored. So
yeah,
I think we just
I guess it's even more turbo year that we did it mainly, like, all the audio of me talking while hiking the rails and then...
talking shit.
Cussing and screaming. I remember when that seg came out, because it's all cussing to start with. My mom was bummed, because she's like, oh... Like, but like,
I thought you loved skiing,
but it's just funny because I don't really mind wearing them. I mean, people hate the lav mics because if you fall on it, it's like another sort of like piece of equipment to kind of smash into. But there's always
that's stress. Yeah.
There's such cool audio to be captured. Not necessarily like what I'm just talking to myself about, but like the between riders as they're like figuring out the spot or like the real live audio of the rail as you're on it. Like, I remember Kyle was real stoked on it, and I'm just down to do whatever anybody that's filming is real stoked on, because usually that's a good sign it's going to get used.
It's kind of silly looking back, like, why not just get a good shotgun mic?
Yeah.
No, but you were shooting from, like, there's a rail in Michigan, one of the first rails you shot, you're shooting from, like, hundreds of yards away, and there's still transmission coming through.
Yeah. It's pretty cool to have audio, because the rail noises make the shot so much better, and, like, unless you had a mic close, like, on a long lens shot, it's just kind of ruined. Because it is that, like, the grinding and the gripping and the slamming for all those different features that makes it so...
Yeah.
Totally.
It feels like you're there. Like, you're doing it, but I don't know. I think the reason we stopped doing it as much is because it's such a nuisance to you guys. And if you're getting, like, angered or stressed out, it's just, like, another thing to think about. And it's so, it's kind of violating a little bit. You're, like, mic'd up. You know, it's, like, NFL style. Like,
oh, yeah.
I've had Tom mic'd up before where, like, he's... he was, like, frustrated with me before. And, like, he would go over and talk with the boys. And I'm, like, dude, I still have the headphones on. I'd be, like, oh, what does he want me to do? And just, like, bitching. And then you kind of... I've heard the athletes be, like, oh, mic's on, mic's on. But it's kind of funny. You're like, I don't know.
I could see a Matt being bummed. Like, what the fuck's up with this, though, dude? I'm not wearing this shit.
Yeah. It was always fun to have a mic on when you got kicked out of a feature, because then you'd, like, get good audio of somebody really
good audio of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, another funny thing, the takeaway from watching the behind the scenes from Michigan is the Taco Bell scene. You film like an entire lunch at Taco Bell.
An entire meal.
Henrik, yeah.
Henrik was so excited. So he had just he's still living in Sweden and not much time in the US. And a lot of Swedish folks were really the Taco Bell and like Fruit Loops. But he just all he ate was fruits. Taco Bell, and he just loved it. So he was like, "Damn, can we go to Taco?" It was like every day. Just so fun. So I was like, "All right, let's go to Taco Bell."
Get a Mountain Dew as well.
Film Urbans and go to Taco Bell.
Man, that was such another one of those trips that was like so special. Like, that was my first time shooting with Henrik, and his first time really getting to know that Wallace Hornbeck and a Met crew pretty well, and the rest had just kind of snowballed into a hell of a season for him. And I think he started to stack shots, and once you start to get a few shots, you're just trying to fill out a segment. And I think he was he went all in that year too. I mean, another insanely good segment.
Yeah, it blows my mind how young he is going that hard. Like, all these dudes are fucking like 23, 24. Met's like an adult in such, he's just like clowning on this kid in some ways. And yet his skiing still holds so much water, and him to be able to just come on that as such a young kid and get it done is staggering.
Yeah. He crushed. I'm trying to think of it. Any other little thing? I mean, we did a little edit at the local ski hill. That was something we liked doing back in the day, is every time we were on a street trip, because it's usually in like Midwest or places without like
big mountains.
Big ski resorts would be kind of like just go to the local ski hill and get some shots. And we did that at Hornbeck's local mountain, and I know it meant a lot to him. And we had some fun with it. I think we edited that on the trip.
Oh, that same year is our first year going to Finland, where we did the same thing, like skied through the resort in Finland, and it's just insane with crazy local kids that are way too hyped, like following us around and stuff.
That was the first time that I realized how big of a deal Wallace was going to be or was, because we went to Finland, and I think it was even big for you at the time, but
yeah,
we went to this local ski hill, and these kids just like swarmed you. Like you were, wherever you went, there was like 30 kids, and I think we were with Matt and Will Wesson. And like,
oh yeah, that was,
it was just me and Matt and Will Wesson skiing around like, oh, just us. Like, then there was these kids just like swarming you, so
following so close. It was like so fun.
Pretty crazy to see.
I mean, Finland in general though was a big move for us. I think that there was some discussion as to whether that trip should happen. I know like Jay Lev was very opposed to Will Wesson even going abroad to film Street because he saw that as a huge waste of money.
Huge.
He wrote Berman really a hilariously long email about something about going up and skiing with reindeers and why, you know, you can do it in New York or all these other. But it was it was bizarre at the time, but that ended up being our spot. I think we went, I've probably been
to Helsinki
five or six times total.
And it
since.
Was,
and it's, we got there, and it's just like, you don't get kicked out. I mean, we say it in these movies, but you don't get kicked out. Tons of features, tons of snow. It was just like, we got so much done.
We almost didn't get anything done. When we showed up, there was no snow, and it snowed on like day two. So it was safe,
sketchy.
But we were very, very worried. But like
driving down the street, you see so many rails.
Oh,
it's just a matter of deciding which sick one you want to hit.
The acting in it is so terrible. Like we're looking left and right so quickly, and it's dark out. You're not seeing anything. Like,
yeah, it's like this is not real.
We're not good actors. Like pretending we're actually scoping. Oh, we look so ridiculous.
Yeah, I had some questionable calls in my day, but you learn. I certainly wasn't like a Hollywood director. Like
I'm saying us, too. Yeah. It's like, what are we doing? Like,
but that was, I can speak for me, Matt, and Will, and maybe you. That was the first time I've ever flown overseas or been to a country besides Canada. So it was like so crazy for us to like,
yeah,
not only just go on the ski trip, but
it was definitely my first time going on a street trip anywhere overseas and first time to Finland. And yeah, when you are used to being in the U.S. where you do get kicked out and you're a little like anxious and stressed all the time, going there where we were covering staircases, we were skiing in the middle of the day, we were doing whatever we wanted, and we felt like it was just such a better, like, when you're not anxious and stressed about like getting kicked out, you're like so much, having so much more fun. Like urban skiing kind of sucks in the fact that you're always a little stressed, where this was
100.
Like we were just eating food, taking snack breaks, taking water breaks, where like normally you're like, I got to go back up there, I might get kicked out next hit. Let's go. And it's like, that was like the first really enjoyable, like no stress. Like,
yeah,
we were just on urban vacation. It was awesome.
Yeah, well, it takes that cat and mouse element out of it.
Yeah.
And then like the Amets of the, like, because Amet is so good at kink rails, but takes a million tries and you get kicked out, where he could just spend all day on it.
Yep.
God, what is that, like an 8 or 10 kink he does?
Yeah, the thing is so gnarly.
So much style. It's insane.
Still wearing eyeglasses, by the way.
Yep. Didn't get LASIK.
He wore eyeglasses because he wore just
couldn't
normal glasses because he couldn't see at night. He was just, I remember before, he just, I can't see. So he got that. And everyone was on one on that trip. And that was my first big trip with Will. And we had a blast. Like, we had this little van that I think we put in the movie, and we just cruised around and the little antics left and right. And we went pretty hard.
There's a great moment in the credits of you just like interviewing all the homies. You're like, what's Will Wesson up to? What's Will Wesson up to? And then you just turn to a stranger on the street. What's Will Wesson up to? And he's so confused. I like that a lot.
It was like funny. We'd like those obnoxious Americans that think it's like, you can say things and people, but obviously English is like the
second
pretty popular language. So we were kind of the idiots.
You guys teased an Amet story last week from that trip. Is there something to revisit there?
Oh,
some shenanigans?
I think it was iTrip.
it might have been a different year, but the story isn't incredible. It's just a story of us celebrating the last night of the trip with some drinks, going out to the bar. We all have flights the next day, but by this point in time, I've learned my lesson with, like, drinking before traveling because I've missed a couple. So I think I stayed in or I went home early. Amet came home last, you know, met a nice lady that night, had a great night, and obviously missed his flight in the morning and then had to book a new one for, like, an outrageously exorbitant amount of,
we,
like,
asked
hundreds of dollars.
We asked the guy at the front desk. I think he, like, didn't have a phone. I mean, it's back before, like, anyways, like, we asked the guy at the front desk, like, because we knew Amet had stayed out late, and we're like, dude, don't stay out. Like, and I remember we went to, like, the front desk, and I asked the guy, I was like, hey, I'm at the Dolly. Like, did he check out? He goes, oh, man. He had me do a wake-up call, but I just kept ringing his phone, and he didn't answer, and I can't, like, go into his room. So he had just slept straight through it.
It's not an incredible story, but we always give him a load of shit for it, and I feel like since then he's gotten way better at, or at least somewhat better, maybe not way better, at not missing flights.
He probably travels, he certainly travels an insane amount now, so I'm sure he's got better stories than that. But that was another trip that I'll never forget.
Yeah, another sick full circle moment with Will Wesson going back there the same year for this movie. Getting clips in Finland again.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, there's still so much you can do there. I mean, I haven't gone in 2 years now, maybe, but it's crazy. Yeah, Will's learned to love it. He's got real close friends over there. But, like, I mean, you can still, maybe you get kicked out of something now that they're, like, they've seen it for, like, 20 years, people doing
right.
But, like, it's just still, like, the old world out there where, like, everything in the U.S., people are building things with aluminum and, like, all these cheaper materials. Like, everything out there is steel and brick and old, like, old world builds. And it's just so much better for, like, the skiing we want to do. Like, every time I go, I'm like, wow, this is so cool. Like, the architecture, the way the cities are designed for walking is so much different than cities out here that are newer, that are, like, designed around cars and elevators and escalators. It's, like, all about walking around town. So there's, like, way more staircases, way more hilly terrain with metal and walls and bricks. And it's just, like, a better place to do urban skiing than almost anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah, I think that's what it is for sure. The layout of that place is crazy. Because it's like, yeah, I mean, I remember the first takeaway there was like, oh, this is like Walsh's Playland, because there's all these, like,
Dub Kinks are
perfect with natural.
Perfect Dub Kinks. Yeah.
I mean, there's some tech tricks in there in that Finland segment I don't know if I could do on a rail these days.
Yeah.
So many switch-ups.
When did the winch come into play? Is that 2010?
I wouldn't even say we used. We did get it for iTrip, and I think it was only used maybe for one shot. Is that there's like a basketball hoop that Hornbeck and Amet hit the backboard on. We really didn't really know.
That was the second time. So the first time we ever used this winch was we were all hanging out in either Salt Lake or Park City. And for one, we had Will Wesson there. And I remember it was all three of us. Yeah. And there was snow on the ground. And remember, we just spent this whole day dinking around. We're like, we're going to bring this thing to a field and test it. And we were looking at a feature that was this, like, we would have had to build a massive step up onto a roof, and then Will was going to get on the roof and then slide off the coping on the side. It's actually the same spot where I think they're building the Woodward.
Yeah.
And it's that field there.
They tore that pump house down, I think.
No doubt. But I remember, like, that was the first time we ever did anything with a winch. And for one, the first time we turned it on, we didn't stake it down. So we're like, this should be all right. Like, there was enough wet snow. We just kind of, like, stuck the wheels in the ground. We're like, this is cool. And then, of course, as soon as you put 200-pound Will Wesson on the other end and, like, gun it, this winch went for a ride and Will didn't go anywhere. So they're like, okay, the stakes serve a purpose. And then once we started testing it out a little more and figuring out that we're going to try to make the feature go, as soon as we got busy, then we got kicked out, which was the most random place to get kicked out of.
That was a pump house for a tubing hill.
Yeah, we're in the middle of nowhere. So then we got shut down there, and I remember the three of us were all driving around, and I was borderline pulling my hair out because it's like there's snow everywhere. There's probably a lot of really important shit that we could be doing, but here my entire film crew is driving around in circles aimlessly with this piece of gear that we don't even know what to do with.
And one, Will Wesson.
And Will Wesson. And we ended up finding this, it was, I don't know, not, kind of like a bell tower.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess like Heber. A little,
yeah.
It was a bell tower before they installed the bell. Because I've drove past it since, and the guy was like, oh, they're going to install a bell next week. And now if you go to it, there's a a bell in the middle, so you couldn't. It's unhittable.
Yeah, it's brand new for sure, but it's just a four-post gazebo type thing that he was like, well, I could, like, do a 180 through that.
Yeah.
I don't think and people are going out of their way to, like, shoot something like that now. So.
No.
That was this, like, just experiment where we have this source of speed that we've never had before. And,
right.
Like, we're starting to figure out, like, what do you even do with it?
There it is. The very first flat ground feature that we made speed for, pretty much. I mean, that was just in the middle of that. That was flat as it gets.
Yeah.
Could have been anywhere.
Well, one of the things that I want to talk about with you, Wally, is the monster jump that we hit at Squaw. Over the course of 2 or 3 days, you learned all these dubs in very quick succession. That was right before we went to Mammoth. And then all of a sudden you took these dubs that you learned on a little 40-foot poppy jump to that massive step over. And that, I felt like, was a huge game changer for you.
Yeah, for sure. The Squaw session, well, it was like a monster team trip that they got everybody together.
Yeah.
And like, not a lot of those shots. I mean, there's a couple in the movie, but so much more of them made it into like that, like, coast, you know, Make Me Famous edit that we made and like all these other different edits. But I mean, that jump was so perfect. It was like this poppy step over, like 45, small, but like you could land on your head. I mean, there's a clip in the credits. I think it's Liam landing on his face.
Yep.
And like, I mean, we exploded, but like something about it was slushy and safe enough that like, I mean, we had done dubs that year before and people were learning them, but like that jump, I did switch, forward, double rodeo, like all these different rotations that like I had never tried, and that's what made, then that Mammoth session, like, so much better, like, so much, like, that was the era of everybody learning it. I don't know what it was about that jump. It was just, like, small enough that you could chuck.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
We've tried to replicate that jump a few times since with, you know, a lot of knowledge and a lot of skill behind a build, and never been able to redo it. It was crazy. Like, whatever it was, that thing was just the perfect little
popper,
you know, mini shred popper that had almost no consequences.
And it was just in their public park.
Yes.
Did they like cut it
rebuilt.
Out a little?
Yeah.
They made it look
it definitely,
a little gnarlier.
Like, it had a gap, and it was built very specifically for this monster team thing. And I remember showing up and be like, oh, it's a tiny jump, like, whatever. And it was, but it was this weird, perfect transition on the takeoff and the landing. Even Casabon, I think, was trying dubs and landing on his head. And it was like, no thing. Whatever.
And looking back on it, though, like, I look at the footage and I'm like, oh, it's no impact if you land at the top. And then all of us on these dubs are landing like 3/4 of the way down. And it's like, no, it's just a step down. Like, why were we going so big on this jump? Just like pure irony. But that one definitely led into like making that Mammoth jump. And still to this day, like that Mammoth jump that year, I was out in Mammoth this spring and they built like the same jump in a slightly different location and just having like crazy
Can't
nostalgia of that session. Like the speed was so perfect. The jump was so perfect. Like lapping
crew.
In the crew in the cat, like every cat ride, we were like broing down who's going to try what. Like it was so slow riding up and down in a cat, but like that crew and that vibe was like better than any session I've probably ever been a part of that year. Like, so many people were learning, and like the crew was from every older guy that was a legend to like all the younger guys to like Parker and Chris were there that year. Like it was like the newest of the new and the oldest of the old, like still like keeping up with each other. It was so sick.
Yeah, it was unreal. I mean, even Will Wesson hit that jump, did a switch sev, which is
switch
kind of crazy.
DeLorme is a huge standout for me. Obviously, that jump session, some people stole the show, but DeLorme, was that it? That was his, that segment was just such an eye-opener for me to watch him. Because at the time, skiing certainly wasn't as, like, going down different paths than it is today. And DeLorme really threw a curveball at almost every feature he hit, and he did a lot of things that, you know, now might seem normal, but he was so ahead of his time, and he was somebody that you couldn't, like, ever spark him to, like, do things. But if he was in a good... He was always the guy that if he was in a, if he was feeling it, that everyone was in a good mood, it's like, look out. Because he, I mean, he's still to this day probably one of the favorite skiers I've ever pointed a camera at. And he tore up Mammoth with a whole new style.
Really quick, just back to that Mammoth jump session. I remember that was a little bit of a, like an added bonus for us. So that year in Mammoth, we were following on the heels of Super Park, and they had all these features on the front side of the mountain that we've been sessioning. And then this step over on the back had been built for something different. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like this little gift that they gave us. They let us hit it. I think it was probably one of the last things that we shot there. And it was very much a one and done situation where, I mean, that session was perfect. Like, there's nothing I would have changed about it, just between the coverage, the tricks, like everything, the crew, the vibe. It was amazing. It really was. But I remember the next day, Henrik's like, man, if we go back, I'm thinking maybe triple. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody even talk about doing a triple.
Yeah.
And it was like, what? And he was like, yeah, I was kind of thinking about it a little bit. He's like, if we go back, that's what I'm going to do. And I remember talking to the Mammoth staff being like, can we go back?
We need to get this.
And for whatever reason, probably the weather and scheduling and whatever else. And, you know, I'm glad we didn't go back, because it was like just this one amazing evening, perfect session. And
lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
But yeah, my impression from that is like, what a difference a year makes, because the Turbo Wendell session was, you know, not even a year before.
Yeah.
And it's like the tricks being tossed, like, you get three doubles in that.
Yeah.
Henrik dub 12.
Henrik has dub 12.
Like, sick dub 12.
It's very, very different situation trick wise.
Yeah. Compared to what the me doing that ungrab double in Wendell's the year before, it was like, now you're doing a double with like one grab into another grab and this rotation and that rotation. Yeah. And like, everybody was getting into it. And it was, that was such a progressive time. And like, the corny interviews of everybody talking about how progressive the session has been. But like, really, it was like that time more than anything. Like, kids are doing crazy and more spins nowadays. But the move from single corks to doubles and being able to grab them and grabbing tricks that seemed like they'd be like so aerialist and turning them into like a switch five to a cork five, like a combination of two tricks in one, was such a crazy era in skiing. Like,
skiing is getting to a place where it's crazy.
Actually, what he originally said was shit's crazy, and we cut the shh out because they're trying to like PG-ify it for Warren Miller, because
Get up too much cursing.
I mean, how about some of those sunglass styles and like the chain?
My God, the styles at the interview spot. You guys should make like a collage of what everyone was wearing.
all like 5XL, 8XL tall tees, and like
you
rocking
the
Spytron sunglasses. Yep. And B-Dog in those Oakley like white like windshield wiper shades.
Style.
This is the introduction of the level one tall tee.
It is.
True.
It is.
I mean, Walsh, I know you wore that blue one like pretty much the entire Quebec trip.
Yep.
And then
green one in the spring. Green one in the spring.
Well, maybe a blue one, a white one, and a black one, but 3X, 4X, 5X. You had to layer appropriate. Like, if you didn't have the layer,
I think there was
a
red one in there too, Wally.
Maybe. Yeah.
So,
great brand ambassador.
Dude, the best. And it's actually kind of funny. So we had dabbled in making some gear in years prior. And I think that the floodgates kind of opened when we started working with Gibberish on these collabs and, you know, started to create more of this like brand identity. And I remember people were asking for level one t-shirts that were bigger, and you guys all on your own were wearing these huge tall tees. And I remember you had an Amplit t-shirt. It wasn't necessarily a tall tee, mm-hmm. but it was long enough that you were able to layer it under whatever else you were wearing, and it would hang out the bottom, and it had some branding along the hem.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's what I want to do. I'm going to put the logo on the chest, and then I'm going to put the branding small in like a chain along the hem so these guys can layer them. And that became the Summer 09 Tall Tee. And, and you guys, you were all at a point in your careers where you either like weren't, you didn't have obligations to wear anything from a clothing sponsor, and almost nobody in the crew did. So it was really, you could wear whatever you wanted. And it was a pretty unique time in the sense that you guys were all the best of the best, like as we've discussed before, like best crew out, but you didn't have these obligations. So, you know, like, yeah, give me some level one tall tees. Perfect. And everybody was wearing them just because they wanted to.
Well, it was the only place to even get them. That was a rare commodity. I mean, yeah, I mean, it was. I think it was dope for you guys to rep level one, but what was that store that everyone... Gen X.
Generation X and Factory for You in Salt Lake. But, like, you couldn't get them. We're all skinny skier kids. You didn't want, like, a wide, long shirt. You wanted skinny, long.
No.
And, like, the sizing was almost just the most perfect thing. Like, everybody wanted to rep the brand, but it was almost like, that's the fit. Like, I need that.
Oh, right, because if you went to Walmart and you get a 4X, it would be just super wide, chunky.
A block.
And then Gibberish really got into the actual cut and sews that really slimmed it down, but just made it.
Sure. But the tall tee thing, man, I remember finding this place like buried in the depths of the dark web in Brooklyn, New York.
On Silk Road?
Oh my God. Not even. Like, I don't even remember how I actually found this place, but it was the most like low budget, barely functioning website. And I called this dude on the phone whose English was very broken. And we started wiring him money, and we'd get these cardboard boxes of tall tees, like slightly different colors and shapes, and clearly like relabeled and mislabeled, like falling off the back of a truck somewhere in New York City. And that became our tall tee supplier. And it was like so sketchy, but this was the only place in the world where you could find these things.
Well, I think he was stoked too, because he wasn't otherwise unloading these really random sized extra large t-shirts. I think that maybe he was originally even had them in stock, or the reason that they were created is like night shirts or something like that.
Maybe, like, man, maybe, but it was just like perfect scenario, and like he became my best friend, and every time we'd call him, he'd be like, oh yes, my friend, we have more. And it's like sometimes you order like the blue, and there's some navies, there's some light blues in there, like it's just a little effect. Yeah, so loose. But I remember like all these other people that were trying to make like branded t-shirts were calling me like, yo, just hook me up with your tall tee suppliers. Like, nope. go find it on your own, man. Like, I've got that on lock. And it was crazy because that was the best marketing and branding that we could have ever hoped for. And it was completely organic, which is what made it work.
Yeah.
Is all you guys just repping this stuff. And you know, between that and the Gibberish collabs, because everybody was on board with the Gibberish program and, you know, wanting that, whether it was the Gibberish stuff on its own or our collab pieces. And just like, you know, never once asked somebody to wear something. It was just, that's what they did. They'd come to the house and go into the basement through the hidden door in the bookshelf and, you know, come out with like an armload of t-shirts.
I mean, every park shoot was like a melee of like who was going to wear what color. You'd have a box of it, and it was like, damn, I wanted to wear red this week. Like, shit, you got the red one already? Okay, yeah. I'll go blue.
Like, Mammoth, for example, we all stayed at Mammoth Mountain Lodge, which, you know, there's a couple rooms that each probably sleep like 10 people. I think we had like a couple of those, and Berman comes in like Santa Claus with like boxes of gear, and it's just like,
here you go.
Yeah, it was entering, I think that 2009 and 2010, Refresh and iTrip is peak Skittles era.
Oh, yes.
Because, like, the color schemes across that movie are just every flavor imaginable.
Well, that was back when you couldn't shoot with black. It was like, hey, you got something bright, but I think that's now changed a bit. And a little bit.
I remember hearing a comment after iTrip about somebody sort of, like, under their breath, but it's like, yo, like, level one movies just turning into, like, it looks like tropical Skittles out there, which is entirely true.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a huge backlash to that, which, you know, like, P. White starting to wear, like, entirely black kits later down the road. But definitely, I mean, yeah, the color is strong.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was represented in all the ski gear at the time, too.
Like, yes, it was.
And you look at, like, the sweet kit that Wally was rocking, and it was like,
yep.
It's all bright.
All super Ahmed's bright.
Under Armour stuff, Hornbeck's DNA stuff.
And like, oh my God, all of it. Bibby's like yellow spider suits.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Everything was just popping. Like, there was not a lot of
subtlety. The Saga, so, like Wiley's blue and I think blue that yellow came, Saga.
You guys can correct me, but I feel like brands, whoever it is, whether it's Saga, Spider, the athletes would be like, can I get black? But black kind of sells on its own, so they would always send out, like, the brightest, kind of the random bright colors.
Yeah.
The stuff Ahmed that doesn't had the go.
Under Armour?
Yeah.
Ahmed made some Under Armour stuff go. He sent that real big starting iTrip.
Yes.
It was great.
Yes. Yes. that yellow jacket with blue pants. That's a pretty iconic duo. Yep. Name a more iconic duo.
Which, if I'm not on that iTrip podcast, goddamn Ahmed Didali. That's like probably a segment that stands out more than that. That's one of the best. Like, I still think, and I mean, Ahmed still is dropped some hammers since, but something about that segment was.
It was
all lined up. He had a song in the beginning of the year, and he was just on one.
Yeah.
It all worked out well.
Something I want to cover real quick with you is after I got back from Alaska, I had been sort of editing a part while I was up there that was basically a joke with the Paradise song and me sort of lip-syncing along with it. And which is
with
just
the
a
selfie cam.
It was just going to be like a bonus feature, right?
Yeah, because that's I just gotten the GoPro One, so I was just messing around with it like on down days in Haines, and then that song Paradise, which is like a David Lee Roth remix, had come off this party mix that Rainville had that our friend Ben Wiltsy had given him. Which is anyway, I was like, I don't know why I thought to use that song, but it was this fuck around bonus edit. And then I started putting shots in that edit while I was up there. And as soon as I got back from Haines, which is like a huge trip for me for, you know, there are a number of reasons, and there's plenty of other stories to go along with it. But I showed that edit. We had all gathered. I think it was at Copper, because I know Riddle was there, Walsh. I know you were there. And I played it, and you're like, yo,
you
like, that's the most entertaining, like, Alaska edit I've ever seen. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
Dude, we were fired up on it because it's so fun. It's so fun and
catchy.
Such a good vibe. It's not
so
like,
different from everything else that was going on at the time and other movies from Alaska, which was like, we are the biggest, baddest, most epic, like,
makes it
death-defying.
So daunting, it doesn't make it look fun to go to Alaska when it's set to AWOL Nation or whatever. Like, it's so awesome, like, to see a good vibe, and, like, you guys look like you had so much fun. Like, I wasn't definitely not the guy to ever want to go ski just lines, and I was like, damn, that looked like a lot of fun. Like, I want to get invited on that trip with Friedel. That looked dope.
Dude, single-handedly, like
helicopter karaoke.
Yes, helicopter karaoke for sure. Yeah, just spitting into the headset, like, acting like such a fool. I had to be like, make sure no one's looking. Just do this real quick.
Hey, guys, look at that zone over there.
Yeah.
That's too funny.
Yeah, but I think it was your reaction was single-handedly that which made me second-guess it being a joke. Or just at least, for better or worse, being like, "Yo, maybe we should put this in the movie." If
so
it's that,
sick.
if those guys, you know, coming from a very jib-oriented perspective, were entertained by this, then maybe that's worth something. So, I guess thanks for that. But
yeah,
also it's like maybe a questionable part. Like,
the first time I saw it, I was so surprised by it, but the second time I watched it, I was like, oh, this works so perfectly contrasting with the Warren Miller stuff, like we were talking about earlier, because it would have been so easy to lean into the big mountain, giganto, epic Alaska thing with him going on. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it contrasts really nicely with what else is going on there.
That's funny.
You mentioned the copper chute. I believe the whale tail feature is there.
Keystone.
That's Keystone. Same deal to me.
That's all right. Yeah, same thing. Summit County.
Yeah. That seeing DeLorme go in on that whale tail that's the highlight of his segment for me, because he just like fucks up the on feature of that whale tail so hard.
The first time a feature was, I mean, that was like a perfect feature was designed for DeLorme. And if you can hear in the background, we're just all, you can hear a lot of Liam Downey, but like we were all just like, what? And I think I remember Keystone, was that the shoot they kept trying to like cut it down early? They're like,
oh my God.
And we
yes.
begged
it
and pleaded,
so
and we like were bribing like ski patrol, but it was like, there was much
all
never
you
before.
Terrain park managers out there, do not shut down your park chutes at 5 p.m. There's a reason why we want to shoot all this golden hour shit, and there's really, a lot of incentive for us to stick around. And that was actually brutal, because I remember it was as soon as the lights started to get good, they're like, all right, guys, thanks, that was cool, time to go home. And it's like, what? Like, where is the disconnect here? Like, you do look around, understand. And, I think that was the beginning of the end of Keystone.
Huh. Man, DeLorme shut it down.
Yeah, he did.
But, I mean, I'm like, God, I'm trying to think of some other. He was doing stuff on, like, the knolls of the Keystone jump that wasn't so big that he was turning.
Oh, man, the switch hand drag tail butter fives and sevens, just like next level, just fuck around stuff that was really the highlight of what was going on.
Yeah. I think that's the first time there's ever been like a knuckle featured as a feature in one of these movies, that he took it seriously enough and went hard on it enough. It's like, yeah, we're going to put the knuckle shots in.
Yeah.
And the other place that DeLorme always shined was, with his boy Tony from Eclipse. Like, Tony, the park builder, Eclipse was, I don't know how much you guys touched, but like Eclipse was like the ski resort that never happened, but
yeah,
they had a resident park builder, and him and DeLorme just vibed so well. So we were just like building things almost specifically for DeLorme. And man, he got up there and just like, he loved the vibe, because it wasn't like a corporate ski resort. It's just like, oh, my homie made this. Like, my homie's lapping me. Like, my homies are filming me. Like, this, it was like, that was a very
special relationship for sure.
Yeah, that was like DeLorme private resort up there.
Yeah. Dude, those clips from Eclipse, he's going so fast. Like the 540 bonk on the like giganto water reservoir type feature, just like
he's extremely fast, and he was always he's a hard one to follow, Cam.
Oh yeah, the hardest part about filming DeLorme is keeping up with DeLorme.
Absolutely,
and he's also somebody what I love about him is he's somebody you kind of got to keep an eye out for what he's doing, because he's not going to tell a filmer and. He might surprise you, so you can't like swarm him with cameras, but like somebody would be like, yo, look over there, like DeLorme's eyeing up some weird, like, so he was kind of always this like mysterious, like, just
that's a point to bring up though.
I don't even know what he was doing it for the homies and just like just good vibes, and you couldn't ask him, hey, go do this trick on that jump. He just did his thing.
You had to get lucky and document it, or be on your
toes. A game. No, it was always a little bit of a challenge predicting, like, what is he going to do? When is he going to drop? That was another thing. It's like, because even if you think you're ready, the drop call on any kind of feature is definitely key to getting your shot going as a filmmaker. And DeLorme kind of threw that out the window, and it's like, yeah, you want this shot? You're going to have to make it happen on your own.
Kept you on your toes. Well, I think we mostly covered an hour, and I know you guys have a lot more to touch on, but thanks for thanks for having us involved in this, and look forward to hearing the rest of it.
Fuck yeah. Enjoy shooting cars.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, boys. Thanks for having us on. Such a good movie to be a part of. That was such a fun one to rewatch this morning before chatting. So
yeah, that's a special one. Probably one of the best level one movies.
Oh, yeah. Should have won way more awards.
Ooh, we can talk about that, too.
Yeah.
Hell yeah, boys.
All right.
We back.
So how'd you get connected with even like having some, there had to be some sort of in to getting to Warren. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's a very roundabout, funny backstory there. And it very much fell into our lap. So good friend of ours from over the years by the name of Greg Heidel, who is one of those guys who knows everybody. And one of his friends, whose name is Dave Morin, similarly is one of those people that knows everybody. He also was one of the early first five employees at Facebook. So superstar tech entrepreneur, lives in a slightly different universe, but he's very much a connector. Again, knows a lot of people, but he's very much into connecting the dots and making things happen. I think that's something that really drives him. And he has a very funny family connection to Warren Miller's family. Dave Morin's grandfather is a doctor, or was a doctor, who delivered Warren's first son, Kurt. Yeah.
In Helena, Montana.
And so Dave Morin, I believe, grew up, born and raised in Montana before he eventually made his way to San Francisco and did that whole thing. But so he and Greg Heidel, I believe, went to the School of Mines together. And that is where they first crossed paths. And they stayed in touch. And fast forward a few years to 2009, I think they had been having some conversations. Dave might have reached out to Heidel and said, hey, I'm interested in helping to put Warren Miller in a ski movie. What would that look like and how would that fit? Heidel immediately thought of us in Level One. It was like, oh, these are the guys. Like, this is the least plausible way to do it, and that makes it the best idea. So that put a spark in them to reach out to me, and I think Heidel sent me a text. I should go back and find that text because it was probably pretty ridiculous looking back at it now. But yeah, we were all like crashing out on the floor of the Wendell staff housing home and got this crazy text. And it was like, whoa. My first reaction was like, hell no. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, why would we want to put Warren Miller in a movie? And again, to just kind of circle back on Kyle's reservations, like, we all express some kind of reservation because it is a square peg in a round hole. And, you know, moreover, like, I mentioned in the voiceover that I wrote, or the script that I wrote for the intro, I very much did watch Warren Miller films as a kid. I feel like everybody from my generation that, you know, paid any attention to ski movies certainly did, and probably still people do today, though I wouldn't know it. But, you know, by the point in time where I was in my late teens and early 20s and I was, you know, diving into what Level One became as a filmmaker, Warren Miller at that point represented everything that I did not want to see and didn't care about in ski movies. It was very much dumbed down, super commercialized, boring. And I came very close to making
Warren filler.
Yep. Very close to making a parody early on in the Level One years called Boring Filler Entertainment. And it never went anywhere just because I think I just didn't have time to actually see it through to fruition. But I'm glad I didn't, because I feel like that would have come up at the time and probably been a red flag that might have put the kibosh on us working with
Deal breaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so we get this crazy text, and I think I jumped on a phone call with those guys that night or maybe the next morning. But the next step was for them to put me on a call with this girl named Rohila Shah, who was Warren's personal assistant. And Warren at that point is 85 years old, and you know, he's not super hands-on with everything, but
no shit.
he's very much his interests and his activities as they're related to any kind of business stuff are all managed by his stepson, Colin Kaufman, his wife, Lori, and his assistant through Colin and Lori, I guess, which would have been Rohila. Mm-hmm. And so my first conversation was with Rohila, and we talked about like this is an opportunity. And I was still very much on the fence. Like, is this something that I'm like asking for? And I'm like borderline politely just having this conversation to entertain it. But obviously the ball got rolling, and as we talked about it a little more, it became something more and more interesting. And what it ultimately turned into was us hustling once we got back to Denver to try to figure out conceptually how to make it work, and eventually ended up writing a script. And I had to actually put together a proposal for Warren that was very much like, here are samples of like things that I've shot and made in the past, and this is how we'd want to do this. So, I mean, to this day, I don't know if Warren actually ever saw any of that stuff or just went to.
I know that he at least saw some samples, because some of his advice was you need to film more slow motion.
Hmm. Well, we talked about that when I actually went out to visit with
him. But he must have seen samples, no?
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
I think he was like, this is, I can't even like, I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah. What is this shit?
Yeah.
I want to ask about the script that you're talking about. Did you write the script for him? And was there any back and forth on what he was going to say between you and him? Or was that all your writing?
I would say 85% of it was my writing. The thing that I did not write was the best part of the whole thing, of course, which was the outro. So a little bit about the process. So we had our almost storyboard and rough cuts of all these segments going into, I want to say probably like the third week of August or something like that. And with the outline of the movie and an idea in mind of all of these parts and what they look like, I wrote a script to get us from point A to point B. Of course, the intro, which was like this cold open, me talking about it, and this borderline, you know, surprise as all of a sudden Warren's voice kicks in.
Yeah.
And then we came up with all these ways to weave him into the story of the movie itself and have him borderline interacting with Friedel and Wallish and a few other people, just kind of like giving his, what I thought his take would be on what skiing had become, which was in many ways very foreign to him. And so it all culminated with myself and Greg Heidel, and I want to say Heidel's cousin, who was an audio engineer, or friend or cousin or something like that, who was an audio engineer. So the three of us actually went out to Orcas Island for 3 days that summer and hung out with Warren at his home. Damn. And it's this beautiful waterfront property, and there's like a little, I don't know, like in-law apartments, separate ADU building where, you know, we set up our little Stalin studio, and for, you know, a couple hours at a time, we'd sit and go over the script and talk with him, and we recorded everything. And so what ultimately ended up in the movie was in large part a combination of what I wrote, and then of course, you know, a few of his random anecdotes. And it was interesting too, because we wanted to give him as much creative freedom as possible, but ultimately I don't think he really liked what we had as far as like skiing and our representation of skiing enough that it really kind of gelled. So I don't know, it was kind of all over the map. And then the last day it was like, all right, Warren, well, this is the script that we wrote. Can we read through this? And he's like, okay, fine. go through it. And you know, it was funny, because in a lot of ways he was a grumpy 85-year-old man.
Right.
And you know, no surprise there. And I was this like, you know, full of energy, young kid just showing up and just kind of trying to infuse my perspective and, you know, connect with him. But, you know, what again ended up in the movie was for the most part the script that I wrote. And then we cobbled together the outro, which wasn't even really planned originally, but put it together from, you know, what really, I guess, all these like gems, all this like knowledge that he was dropping.
Well, when prompted, he would freestyle
for sure,
and he was quite sharp at that point to, I don't know, sort of reminisce and but also talk about. I think he had a lot of talking points that sort of
absolutely.
He was very much in a retrospective, and why, you know, he felt as though, and he did, and understand what the appeal of skiing was, and in very simple terms, and a lot of his experience and how that like intertwined with stuff. So he could very much like nail that.
There were universal truths.
That's exactly the word I was going to use for it.
He had been espousing since his early years. I mean, it was this like this quest for freedom, and this using skiing is this just, you know, freedom and an expression, and, you know, ability to get outside and separate yourself from the quote unquote real world and just like sink into it. And I mean, these are things that, you know, he spoke to in the 40s and the 50s and, you know, ring true today.
Yeah. And, pretty finely tuned.
Yes.
Some to the point where it was canned, but other stuff, very raw. What he would, if you prompted him in the right way, I feel like, or he got there, he had, I mean, you guys recorded a lot of material.
Hours, and like probably 10 hours.
I remember sifting through it, and he, when prompted, would just like go off, and he had a really sharp memory still. I mean, we're talking about movies we made 10 years ago. He's talking about stuff that he filmed 40 decades. Years ago, and he remembers it like it was yesterday. So
yeah,
impressive as fuck.
I mean, once the topic of like Chamonix was brought up, he was like, we did this and this and this, and I had to sift through all this footage or this audio, and I was like, whoa, these are crazy stories. We can't use it for anything, but like, damn, Warren,
get sued again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it didn't fit in our movie.
No, he's talking about
can't tell 5-minute anecdotes.
No, like, he's talking about riding down on top of cable cars and like doing all this crazy shit. People falling into crevasses, like all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Like really cool stories from like the, you know, like golden days, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s. Gotta go
cobble together a podcast with that.
Man, I mean, there would be some rich stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe that's worth a phone call or two.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the next. So when you left there on a good note, though?
Absolutely. I mean,
none of the tensions to come foreshadowing?
Oh, no, no. Like, it was an amazing experience. Like, I left there on an absolute high. I mean,
sick.
I'm not easily starstruck or impressed with people or nervous around people for who they are and what they've accomplished. But this was one of those few situations where it was like, oh my God, like this man is in a lot of ways this like living legend. And yeah, I mean, we got to actually hang out with him. We went crabbing and he's like lifting these like 50-pound crab pots like out of the water. And like we'd have dinner with him every night and his wife Lori would make us awesome dinners, and it was just like a once in a lifetime unforgettable experience. And I definitely like left feeling so good about what we got. Definitely overwhelmed because it's like, all right, now I got to figure out how to piece all this together. And like I said, it was probably even more than 10 hours of content. I mean, it was crazy. And while a lot of it was just like, all right, we're gonna, you know, go through this take of the script, you know, so much of the best stuff were these little hidden gems that we had to pull out and kind of like manipulate into a way to make them work with what we were trying to say. And so, yeah, I came back to Denver and probably slept 2 to 3 hours a night for the next few weeks and put this all together and finish it just in time for our premiere at the Bluebird Theater. And we had Dave Morin came out, Greg Stump, who had been in touch with us and a few other people, like somehow he came out as well, which was a really crazy experience. And it was this like...
We talked about him last episode, but can you clarify exactly who Greg Stump is for the youngins?
So Greg Stump started making... Well, he grew up competing in freestyle skiing. He is a very creative, very smart individual who has an awesome voice. He did a lot of radio over the years and went on to be a ski filmmaker. And he was the antithesis of what Warren Miller was doing with his films in the 80s and into the 90s.
He was a rebel ski filmmaker in the mid 80s.
He was the early counterculture.
He was the early counterculture. He sort of was a generation bridge between, I guess, us, but, you know, certainly Warren Miller in this, you know, 60s and 70s. Mm. And then he was like, he captured the zeitgeist of
extreme skiing
when Glenn Plake was at his height and Mike Hattrip and Scott Schmidt and then those guys, which are, you know, legends from the extreme skiing explosion in the 80s and early 90s.
Work.
And yeah, those, I mean, very successful. I think Greg Stump films and his name is like synonymous with that era.
Cool. Very much so. And he had like this instantaneous overnight success because he was making a product that was unlike anything anybody had seen before, both in his approach to filmmaking and in the actual content. And it was this like...
It was cool.
It was so cool. It was this like...
Mohawks and cool music.
And leather jackets and neon stuff. And yeah. Just
Cliff
like...
Hux.
Yeah.
It was the freshest breath of air that had been brought into ski filmmaking and action sports in general at that point. Because there wasn't much of a, you know, action sports filmmaking genre outside of skiing.
Yeah. And the skiing was starting to get in a rough place in the late 80s and early 90s.
Mm. All boring, if you will.
Yeah.
But Stumpy showed up and was an overnight success. I think he did exceptionally well. Like, fucked up well to the point where...
You're talking financially?
Financially. Yeah. Mm. And this is when...
Overnight, like within 5 years.
Crazy.
Within like a year or two, I think was his story. Like he couldn't keep track of how many VHS tapes they were selling. And very fortunately, he had the wherewithal to give control of his finances to somebody who bought a lot of real estate, a bunch of stuff in Hawaii and wherever else. Because he knew,
Malibu.
I think he knew at that point that he
Aspen
was just going to spend it all. Which yeah. I think he spent every penny that he could that wasn't otherwise tied down.
And he was in the process of selling these root properties when we met him in 2009
yep.
to continue to fund a
party lifestyle.
Yeah. the first time I met him.
So he could fly out to your premiere and be there to party with you guys.
I think one of the first time I met Stump was in Aspen at the meeting, and he was there just to party, not playing a movie. And he had just returned from – we were at the pool, and he had returned from an art store in Aspen, which you can imagine what prices are, and had purchased an original cop print of the photo of when Muhammad Ali met the Beatles, and it was signed. And it's huge. And he's walking through by the pool with his photo being like, look what I just bought. And I was like, what in the actual fuck? Like, that is, I mean, that's a dope piece of memorabilia, but like, who are you, dude?
It's like, just sold one of the condos in Hawaii and bought a photo. But
back to the blueberry.
Yeah.
Sure. A character of epic proportions. So he was there. I think part of it was he was working on a film which became like a multi-year project called Legend of Oz, which was his documentary follow-up to his pinnacle film, The Blizzard of Oz. Mm-hmm. And he had been in touch with Warren and his camp and in turn me. And so he knew that Warren was going to be in this movie. And this was like this crazy, like hot button topic that would become. And so he came out for the premiere just to hang out and party and actually interview us, which was the next day.
He was documenting the legacy of ski films starting from like the Nazis were making ski movies in 1930s Germany all the way to
Riefenstahl.
All the way to Level One being like the new kids on the block or whatever.
Yeah.
Word.
So he came out. Dave Morin came there, Colin Kaufman and Rohila and a bunch of other folks from Warren's camp were there. Warren didn't make it, but that was no surprise. And we had the sold out show at the Bluebird Theater. And again, this is a surprise. Nobody outside of the people that are involved. Did any of the athletes even know?
No, this was like, I was going to say, like, mind you, this is airtight. Like, this is, we did not want to advertise the fact that Warren was in the movie whatsoever. And it was just a surprise for the people that showed up.
Yeah, it's funny too because later in the lawsuit that we'll get into, I think that the Warren Miller Entertainment camp suggested that we kept it a secret because we knew that we were going to get in trouble, which was the last thing we had on our mind. More than anything else, we kept it a secret because we thought that if people heard about it, that they would prejudge the whole concept to be this like mismatch, like failure, because again, it didn't make sense. And here we have this finished product that we felt pretty good about. And it's like, we're not going to tell people, we're going to let people just see it and take away what they will. And that's the only path forward. So we have this world premiere, and of course, you know, it kicks off with my voiceover, and like 60 seconds in, I mention Warren, and then he drops the words, "Thanks, Josh." And like the whole fucking theater just lost it.
Really? I think there was almost a pause.
There was. There was. What? But it was as soon as like real? It clicked. It was like at least that's how I remember it. I just remember like people just screaming, yelling to the point where as soon as they understood or thought they understood what was going on, though we can loop back on that. But I know some people after the fact weren't even sure if it was real or if it was like, the whole thing was fake.
Right.
Because some hologram shit. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you could just like have a voice actor just who sounds a little bit like Warren. And I will say, that was another one of my big takeaways.
A Warren deepfake.
Do that new Adobe software. Yeah. But you could have definitely faked it if you really wanted to. But the man's pipes were the exact same golden pipes that he had, you know, 50 years prior.
It's like, also, we're not watching this movie in a quiet cinema setting.
Level one premieres are parties.
And the Bluebird Theater was... Yeah, I mean, nothing has changed since then at all in terms of our word premieres, but Bluebird Theater is a 400, 500 person capacity like music venue on Colfax.
600, and we had 650 people in there.
Oh, yeah, there's your numbers. Either way, it's like an intimate music space on Colfax. The place is packed to the gills and it gets rowdy as fuck. So people are not, you're not hanging on every word necessarily. It's more of like, I think that was Warren in the intro. You know? Which, I mean, as the lawsuit creeped up, it was like, if you guys were actually at the premiere, you realize that it was not quite what, like, it's more of this, like, overall vibe. Yeah. It's not like, I don't know. It was.
But where were the first inklings of this lawsuit? Where did it start to...
Oh, it wasn't so much an inkling as somebody banging on the door of my house and serving me with like a stack of papers that probably weighed 20 pounds. And it was a like multi-hundred page federal trademark infringement lawsuit along with a cease and desist demanding that we immediately destroy all copies of the film, cease any intention to promote and distribute it, and cancel the Boulder show, which was like 3 days away.
So, and this is right after the Denver premiere? What's
the
timing
here? This was probably on Monday, sometime on Monday, because the premiere was on a Saturday. And then Sunday morning, we got up, we did these interviews at this, what was that hotel? The Jet Hotel with Greg Stump, where he was so out of his mind on however many drugs he could get into his system. The dude was literally falling over and knocked over like a brand new camera, like on a tripod, while he was trying to interview me. It was nuts. It's like, who is this guy? And like, we like took a break and then like went.
It was bonkers.
Dude. It was unreal. I mean, that was like Decker's first introduction to Stumpy, really. And like, we're all just like sitting around hanging out in the basement of this swanky ass hotel. And he's just out of his mind. I'd love to see that footage. It exists. It's somewhere.
Yeah.
Unless like.
Let's do a press record.
It's possible. Absolutely possible. But, anyway, so like we are on this absolute high. Like everybody is so excited. I mean, it was just like the best vibes. It's like, you guys, 10 years, congratulations. This is like a crazy movie. Like you guys like somehow put together like this cross-generational old and new thing without alienating your audience and creating this like bigger picture scenario all about skiing. Like, fuck yeah, we did it. And we felt so good about what we had accomplished. And then, are you Josh Berman? Yeah. Like, you've been served. Wait, what do you mean? Like, what am I being served with? What do you got? What do you got for me?
Right.
And of course, the process server's job is just to leave it there and like confirm that they have left you with this thing. And my mind is blown. And I'm what, like 30, maybe 31? 31.
That was exactly 10 years ago. Yeah. So 31. Minus 10 years.
Yep. thank you for the math on that one. Was that 27 or 40? I don't know. Yes, I would have been 31. But I felt like, you know, that sounds pretty old in retrospect, but like, you know, we're still working out of my house. Like, I felt like a kid in a lot of ways. And all of a sudden I'm served with this thing. I'm just like, what does this mean? And like, I'm
dad help.
Yeah. Like, I am terrified. And I immediately called, I think maybe even Heidel first. And then I called Colin Kaufman. I was like, Colin, like, what do we do? Like, and I think that there might have been some suggestion during my time at Orcas Island from Colin that the WME might not be excited about the idea of Warren working with me. Like, it was just kind of broached as like an off the hand kind of like comment that, you know, just they might not like this.
So we're
like,
talking WME. That's Warren Miller Entertainment, or
WME is Warren Miller Entertainment.
Maybe you should fill in the backstory with that real quick.
Sure, sure, sure. So Warren Miller, the man, of course, started making ski films back in, well, they're celebrating 70 years right now. So
in the 40s, after World War II or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And went on to create this amazing legacy of ski filmmaking history. And he, in turn, sold the family business to his son, I want to say in the late 80s?
No, it would have been in the 90s.
Early 90s?
Early, yeah.
I didn't
say 93.
Okay. I did not do my research prior to this podcast. I used to know all these numbers pretty well. So I'm apologizing in advance if I've got some of the info wrong. Yeah. But he sold it to his son for a very nominal fee. I mean, it's like, here is the family legacy, boy, like, carry the torch, and this is going to be amazing. Son's like, thank you very much, Dad. 2 years later, selling it to AOL Time Warner for lots of money, which was not what Warren had in mind when he gave Junior the family business, and definitely, you know, was against everything that Warren stood for. Was all of a sudden this like massive corporation controls everything about him and his history. And what made it even worse was part of the deal with selling it to his son, Kurt, of course, was a 10-year, I want to say a 10-year or 10-picture addendum through which Warren would provide these annual voiceovers. So all of a sudden, Warren is contractually obligated to continue providing these voiceovers for these movies that are not part of his family anymore, and
they are reliant on, because that's the heart and soul of the films.
Is right.
Warren,
his brand.
The narrator. It's like if BBC's Planet Earth was not, all of a sudden, not narrated by David Attenborough. It's that equivalent.
So yeah.
They needed that.
Sure.
But, and it was his name attached to the whole thing.
Absolutely. Well, more than needing it, they just got it because it was in a contract and there was no way out. And so Warren, I think, wasn't very happy about it and very regretfully had to provide these additional, you know, probably 7-8 years of voiceover work. And after that came to a close, he's like, fuck this, I'm never doing that again. And Warner Miller Entertainment, WME, is like, that's okay. We own your entire catalog. We're just going to piece together all these voiceovers moving forward and pretend like you did this year's film.
Wow.
And so, I mean, that was a low blow to him even more, and just this charade that he was still part of the process and part of the movies, and he wasn't, and he was not happy about it. But
he'd sold his name and likeness.
Yes, he had sold, and this is what it all boils down to in this lawsuit. Eventually, it is decided and it is concluded that he did very clearly sell his name, his voice, and his likeness.
Wow.
As part of this contract, which was a little deeper than he had thought. And to back up a step, I had actually signed a contract with Warren. I think it was his camp that came up with this concept, which I think was to protect everybody, which me in particular, which stated that he had the right to provide the services that he did and that Level One was paying him. It was like, $500 or $1,500, like a super nominal token fee,
right,
just to show some sort of financial exchange and this being like a legitimate contract.
We were also, to make a note of this, not the only film this year to use Warren Miller's voice. There was a documentary done about the Jackson Hole Air Force called Swift Silent Deep, something like that.
Yeah.
That used...
JK did that.
Yeah. Used a blurb from Warren.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. They were actively, I think, trying to exercise his freedom a little bit.
Sure. And, sure.
To dabble in some newer material outside of...
And we were very much this avenue to do that. And and also, you know, side note, we've already discussed the fact that this is our 10-year anniversary film. It also happened to be Warren Miller Entertainment's 60-year anniversary film. So all of a sudden you have this situation where Warren Miller, the man, has no representation or no bearing whatsoever in his namesake's 60th anniversary film. And all of a sudden, here he is showing up in these kids' 10-year anniversary film, which I think really he felt awesome about, but was really something that got under the skin of Warren Miller Entertainment very immediately. And their answer to that was...
Beyond got under the skin. I mean, there was incredibly threatened by that.
Yes, yes. And their knee-jerk reaction... Well, that's the problem, though, is the knee-jerk reaction was to be threatened by it instead of having any... constructive conversation about it, which would have been certainly in their best interest long term. But I think they, knowing whatever little they did about Level One, they thought we're gonna sue this kid and we're gonna scare the shit out of him with this lawsuit and all this language, and he is going to call us crying and pleading and say, I'm so sorry, I'm gonna roll over and die here, just I'll do whatever you want. I think that's what they assumed would happen.
That's a tactic, surely.
For sure. It was definitely a scare tactic to some extent.
Well, it's a corporate tactic.
Yes.
It's like, we'll make this, we'll just stop this immediately with throw a few dozen lawyers, not dozen, but like a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, probably a dozen lawyers. Yeah. Pretty all high powered firm. Yeah. And so I called Colin up and was like, Colin, what do I do? And he's like, don't worry about it. We will figure this out. We will help you work through it. Like, borderline, we saw this coming, maybe. Like, I don't want to put those words in his mouth because that might not be accurate. But to some extent, they were prepared for, I think, some kind of response, whatever it was. I mean, it's probably a little more intense than what they had ever envisioned. But here
it
is.
They wanted to stand up for his autonomy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so immediately, they had Warren as a good lawyer in place. I mean, certainly he's done business for his entire adult life, and they've got a team that they've worked with. And so they helped me file a motion to dismiss the cease and desist, which would have prevented us from screening the movie in Boulder, which was the immediate concern. And then, like, you know, putting a stop to reproduction or production of the DVD copies, which, you know, like, we just sent the master off and, like, you know, we don't have control, or that's just going to happen. Unless we have to put a stop to it. But, you know, the immediate issue was this Boulder premiere and other premieres too. And so the judge dismissed their motion.
Their cease and desist.
Their cease and desist.
Yeah.
And
for
the Boulder premiere.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, well, you guys, like, there's no immediate, like, harm being caused by this, or your filing doesn't suggest that there is or prove that there is. So we're going to let this continue unless and until and if you prove otherwise.
Right.
So we went forward. 2 days later, I think it was, or maybe 3 days later, Warren then filed a motion to intervene, which meant that he was entering the case to join me as a co-defendant.
Really?
Basically, because he was able to file a motion that made it clear enough that his rights were potentially being infringed on, and he considered himself a co-defendant along with me.
It's like stepping in front of the bullet, I guess.
Yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
Yeah, it's big. If they're not suing him too, like, it's just you. That's
absolutely
huge.
He's, and then,
like, basically Level One is the proxy defendant. He's like, now, like, I'm the defendant.
He's like, sue here
me.
I am.
Sue me.
And so then,
bitch.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden the case legally becomes Warren Miller Entertainment versus Level One and Warren Miller, which was Warren Miller Entertainment's absolute worst fucking nightmare.
Very bad optics.
Yeah, dude. Especially when they're trying to sell their 60th movie that has a voiceover piece together from all his archival stuff.
Well, I think at that point it was Johnny Mosley. He was doing voiceover work.
Okay. Yeah.
But they're still trying to keep it copacetic and, right. You know, as if Warren Miller is still
nobody
to the general population.
They got
to
get that Miller. Warm, fuzzy Warren Miller feeling. Yeah.
To the average audience member, Warren Miller is the maker of this movie.
Right.
They don't know the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's 85? Oh. Like,
good for him.
Yeah. Like, that's great. He's still editing his movies. That's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, there's just like this naivete that was so persistent in his audience in general. And that's
facade
that's
got
of it. Yeah,
blown
absolutely.
Off here.
Mm-hmm.
So quickly. So quickly. But to backtrack even, I think, before that, so take us to this Boulder premiere.
Yeah.
So we used to do like a smaller premiere in Denver, which was still the world premiere, and then another like smaller medium-sized premiere in Boulder before we put all our eggs in the Denver basket a couple years later. But we had booked, it was probably a Wednesday or Thursday night, the Boulder Theater in downtown Boulder, which is a pretty good-sized venue. And, you know, that was Level One's second home, if you will. And, you know, we had lots of connections there. So it was still a good-sized show. And they sent Warren Miller Entertainment's attorneys as plants to try to like
and
burn the house
potentially
down,
more of their employees as well.
Yeah.
It was,
we don't know how many plants they had there.
Well,
so in all my years of doing this, I cannot recall.
We have an idea.
Yeah, we do have an idea. I can't recall ever being at another show where management came up to me afterwards to talk about all the complaints that they had from audience members.
Hmm.
People coming to the box office requesting
a refund
on their ticket. Hmm. Never before.
Yeah. Because
why?
Because it was late, it was unorganized, because they didn't think the movie was good. I mean, basically trying to create this scenario where they're going to use this event to say, Level One is tarnishing the Warren Miller name because look at this event that they had and all these people complained. It was their fucking staff and the attorneys.
Hmm.
And so the day before,
To try to sabotage it in any way possible.
Yeah.
It was some grimy shit for sure. So the day before the premiere, you know, I started doing some research on my own and looked at the website of the legal firm that had been listed in the lawsuit and going through the list of all these names, their attorneys.
They're based out of where?
Boulder.
Okay.
Boulder. Oh. Yeah. Which is where Warren Miller Entertainment was based out.
Okay, that's a crucial factor.
We're in
the Lion's Den.
Yeah.
Or the Hornet's Nest, however you want to say it. And so most of these attorneys are these like middle-aged dudes, of course. And there was this one young blonde girl. And I just remember she like stood out like a sore thumb because she was the only person that wasn't like a middle-aged man or like older dude. And so we had made these t-shirts as kind of like this rebuttal that said, Warren Miller is my friend. I mean, just like, you know, went to one of those print shops and just like got some black.
Yeah, like a
t-shirts.
Single day turnaround.
Yeah.
Because I mean, this is very immediate.
Right.
Anyway, we're all wearing these ridiculous like black and yellow t-shirts. Say Warren is my friend. And this girl comes up to us before the show. We're all upstairs in the Boulder Theater and is way too chummy. Like she's putting her arms around everybody like, oh, you guys, like this is so great. Like it was a little over the top and she's asking to take pictures with us and asking us to pose for pictures. She's asking about our t-shirts and if they're for sale. It's like, well, no, they're not. She's like, well, you guys should make them for sale. Like you should definitely make them for sale. Like just like very bizarre behavior.
Then you would be selling something with Warren Miller's name on it.
Ding, 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 ding. So I recognize this girl almost immediately. It's like, wait a second. This is that chick, Kelly Bergelt, who's listed as one of the attorneys on this lawsuit. I was like, get the fuck out of here. So I played it kind of coy. And I was like, oh, hey, like, do I recognize you from somewhere? She's like, oh, no. I was like, what's your name? And she made up some name. Just straight up lied. And I was like, no, wait a second. Like, your name is Kelly. She turned ghost white. I was like, Kelly Bergelt, you're an attorney for blah, 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 blah. Turned even whiter. And like jaw dropped. And it's like straight up like, lady, you just misrepresented yourself. That's fucking illegal.
Yeah.
And you are here trying to sabotage shit, get evidence, like whatever it is, like in a very illegal capacity, you could get disbarred for what you were doing. And
I wish there was photo evidence of her there.
Well, we'll get to what she said about the whole thing. Uh-huh. But then at the time, she's like, oh, no. Like, I'm just here as a fan. Like, I love you guys and Level One. This is awesome. I was like, you are not here as a fan.
Yeah.
You just lied about your name. You're making all kinds of shit up. You're trying to, like, incriminate us by suggesting that we sell something with Warren's name on it. Yeah. Like, and so for the rest of the night, I stuck to her like glue. Like, I remember somebody asked, like, Decker's like, we should kick her out. And I was like, yeah, we should kick her out. I was like, no, you know what? I'm just going to make her as uncomfortable as possible. And I sat down right next to her during the premiere and just kind of leaned in the whole time. And she was just like feeling the heat. But yeah. I mean, that's the best thing I could do at the time. But anyway, it was such a weird vibe because, again, like,
it was, you know, so fucked.
Yeah, this cross between this excitement about this movie that we had made and just this like amazing vibe that I felt like we had created with this insane negativity and just like, you know, lying and cheating and corruption that's basically going on.
Well, there
the
was
side.
This middle-aged man that I had to deal with that had put up, he was making a scene. He was like, this is unbelievable. He's like, I paid hard-earned money. This is a guy that's like in his mid-50s.
Yeah.
I paid hard-earned money to come watch the show, and you're starting an hour later than planned, which we certainly were. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
Pretty standard issue like, for our premieres, though.
Right, but you build the hype.
Like,
that's how you let it roll.
I was like, yeah. And so I was like, I'll put out this brush fire. I did not immediately make a connection between – I thought it might be some kid's dad.
That's not your first instinct is to be like, this person's lying to me.
But it all – like, and so I sat with him for like 45 minutes, dude, being like, I'm so sorry, man. Like, everyone here is enjoying themselves, and there is literally no one else in the audience having this kind of issue. And I was like, well, like, if you're not satisfied, we'll refund your ticket. And like, please, like, we're doing our best here. And like, he just kept being like, this is unbelievable. And like, just trying, like, fabricating his anger. And I was like, It was bizarre.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to, like, put out that brush fire and make – I was like, this is the first time I've ever seen somebody unhappy, let alone, like, furious at a
Level
1 show.
Gotta do some customer service.
Totally, dude. I was like, this is, like – it took me aback. But it wasn't until, like, after the show and I realized it hit me like a fucking wave. I was like, oh, that's like a plant.
Straight up.
And who knows who this guy was.
Yeah.
But, like – unbelievable, right? Like, he was just there.
I think he worked for like ski or skiing or something like that. He was just like a person who was part of the whole thing that they had sent all these people to make a fucking fuss and make a ruckus. It was really weird.
Sheesh. And it was so from like the most negative angle, right? It just
made these
me
were all people
sick.
That stood out anyway, because again, like our average demographic, we're talking like teenagers to young 20s, and you had these like
in a college town, especially
in a college town, you had these angry like middle-aged people. It was like, what are you doing?
Not many people in there over the age of 25.
No,
I would say it like probably 90% of the people in there under the age of like 23.
Right.
But yeah, very, very gross, toxic.
It's straight up toxic. Straight up.
So coming out of that, you're like, holy shit.
Yeah,
what's going on here?
Business in the worst way possible. And meanwhile, the media is getting a hold of the whole thing, and it just...
Like ski media or bigger than ski media?
Bigger than ski media.
Denver Post. New York Times.
Really?
Like, you name it. Like, it was all over the place. Well, it was this like flashpoint of like Warren Miller Entertainment. Like, that name meant something. In, like,
household name.
Household name.
Universally known.
And all of a sudden, there's a lawsuit between the namesake company and the person themselves.
Yeah.
It was just bizarre, and people were trying to make sense of it. And so you guys then headed right to IF3.
Yeah.
And I believe I went to the meeting in Aspen. Were you guys there?
Nope, because I also went to the meeting.
Okay, so that was probably another week later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. IF3 was early that year.
Okay.
Like September, and then the meeting would be in October.
Okay, no, that makes sense. Because I was trying to just remember like the timeline there. Because I remember it was at like the pinnacle of just like the media craziness when we were at the meeting in Aspen. and it became like the center point for one of these actual meetings where like everybody's gathered together talking about stuff. And I remember that, we're doing a lot to kind of explain what was going on. I remember Todd Jones from TGR was there, and he was like, stood up, was like, fuck yeah, like, you guys, like, stand your ground, like, run them out of town. And I just remember, like, thanks, Todd, because, you know, again, I still, like, felt like I was a little kid to some extent, and, like, Todd Jones, like, oh,
he's in our corner. Titan of industry.
He's fully in our corner. But I think that at that point, there had been this flurry of publicity. And it very quickly, you know, I was talking earlier with Decker about how I was scared briefly by this and just felt like all this negative energy that I never felt before regarding a freaking ski movie.
Right.
But it very quickly became apparent that, like, the public groundswell was like 100% in our favor. And the groundswell was bigger than you could ever imagine. So it was almost like, oh my gosh, like, this is like more than we ever bargained for, ever asked for, and it's all in our favor, and we're getting publicity that money cannot buy.
No. Yeah.
And it was like, whoa, like, what the fuck? But, like, this is actually kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And I remember, to circle back on Stump, seeing him in Aspen and him having inside connections at Warren Miller Entertainment. And he was like, yeah, just talk to those, like, this director who I won't name, but he's
Max,
like,
Purvey. That's fine. No. I mean, he was the point man in this whole thing.
He was like, yeah, he told me he'd rather be working at Walmart right now as a greeter than dealing with this shit. And I was like, word, dude, you sowed the seed for that one.
Like,
if they had embraced it, it's bringing, like, there could have been an amazing collaboration there, because it was essentially making Warren Miller relevant again in my mind. It was never like a bash at Warren Miller Entertainment. It never even crossed our freaking mind. It never even crossed our mind that would be, like, I mean, now it is in retrospective quite obvious why they were threatened by it. But, like, if they had been any level of mediation there before, like, a freaking corporate lawsuit,
calling me, driving over to my house office, like number of a half
guys, like, this is like email. This is like actually
a telegram,
this could be hours? Like spun, like, in a more
so I think we kind of skipped the linchpin of the whole lawsuit. Is what they had suggested and named in the lawsuit was that we were effectively damaging, very specifically, damaging the Warren Miller Entertainment brand and name by our use of Warren in the movie. And, like Friedel said, I mean, it was the polar opposite in reality, is that all of a sudden all these kids, like myself included, felt like, in a rewind a year, like, Warren Miller, like, whatever. But, you know, seeing him in the context of what we were doing introduced him to a whole new generation of people that probably new or familiar with the Warren Miller Entertainment or Warren Miller brand, but didn't relate to it. And all of a sudden it's like, yo, yeah, Warren was talking to Tom Walsh in this movie about
he's down with the
cause. Like, fuck yeah.
And Warren Miller could still have their movie.
Right.
Like, absolutely. It didn't take anything away from it.
It was their lawsuit that damaged their brand and exposed. They directly exposed to the world throughout this media coverage
all their dirt.
All their dirt and the fact that Warren wasn't associated with them.
Right.
We didn't expose that for all our movie shows is that Warren's just branching out and doing some other stuff as well. But, like, they
anything that it ties him in further to his legacy, because you'd never know. It's like, oh, he's still kind of doing it.
Yeah. Whereas like through their lawsuit, it made it very clear in the places like the New York Times that Warren Miller was no longer involved with them.
In fact, had major beef.
It's like some very all these reporters, bad blood.
The reporters, like, put that, like, center stage. Like, oh, and this is why there's this longstanding beef and this, like, family issue.
They turned over stones themselves that were, you know, never.
Wasn't me.
Wasn't in their favor, right? Like, I mean, I can't. They just, like, totally fell on their own sword with that one. But
sorry, not sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did they not win, though, given all the resources available at their disposal? And as you mentioned, their legal ownership of his likeness and voice.
Sure. Well, all that was still really in question at that point, too, because Warren is like, I can do whatever I want. Like, okay, this contract has expired. This period of time has expired. I'm free to use my name, my voice, my likeness for whatever I want. And that was his belief.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain people that have suggested over the years that we got used for him to exercise that right. Mm. It was kind of like, oh, let's take this company and see if this sticks.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't know. That's neither here
nor
there.
It's a plausible theory. But,
that's a valid theory to have. And, you know, like, I didn't feel used, but like,
no. I felt very fortunate to have had that opportunity. I mean, it was really just like,
yeah,
as a ski filmmaker, I mean, that is the most golden of opportunities you could ever have. And, you know, I think that, like Friedel said, I mean, there's publicity and PR that came from this that was well beyond what money could ever buy. And
or that we could ever dream up. I mean, we never in a million years thought that this was going to be the windfall.
No,
it was very, like, as you know, we talked about with Decker, we were mostly concerned about alienating our core audience.
Yeah. Like, we just don't want to piss people off. Like, we were
treading
status quo,
lightly,
like,
with his involvement.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's ironic on multiple levels.
So the next phase of this, because it became a full blown, like, big deal lawsuit. And was me retaining an attorney in coordination with Warren. And then he had his separate legal team back in the Pacific Northwest. So, I mean, there are multiple teams of attorneys. And I was working with this guy named...
Gotta love him.
Yeah. Well, this guy named Ben Lieb, who I would say was probably, you know, early 40s at that point, 10 years ago, who... you know, understood where we were coming from and was very sensitive to the fact that we couldn't afford to just, like, dive into the deep end with this. And Warren, at the same time, was offsetting a lot of these legal costs, like, through his own goodwill, because he, you know, just offered to do so. And so the bills that I'm getting were probably, you know, 10% of the bills that Warren is getting on a monthly basis from the same legal teams. And I mean, thank God he did that, because I couldn't have afforded to deal with it otherwise.
Yeah, that's something I've been wondering for a long time, not knowing the details on this. Yeah. Like, how the fuck?
I would say, like, all in, it probably costs level one, 20 to 25 grand in legal fees, something like that. Somewhere in the low 20s, which was, like, you know, borderline breaking.
Right.
As far as, like, a financial commitment at that point. But... you know, again,
we don't have a legal defense fund.
No.
No.
But I think you, Josh, you expressed in the interview with Leeson Stone that you had heard somewhere that you haven't made it as a business owner until you get sued.
Absolutely. Well, that's something that a few people told me at the time. Like, you are not successful unless and until somebody sues you. Because if you are not successful, then nobody gives a fuck and wants to take anything from you.
Which is a very American shame.
I mean, that is not...
Yeah, that is just gross.
That is so gross. That is a flag that I would never wave proudly, but I think there's something to be said for it, too, because, like, seriously, if you are not doing well, nobody's going to bother trying to take something that you don't have. Yeah, but all of a sudden,
in the United States, if you're successful, like, people want it, they're going to...
They want a piece of that.
Get a piece.
Yeah, and that's been true with, like, every like... big deal thing that we've ever done, somebody's sued me about when we've done something cool or right. Yeah, which is sad, which is absolutely fucking sad. It's all these crazy people. Anyway, get into that more in another podcast, but as far as wrapping up this one goes, so the next real step that I recall that's of note was my deposition. So a deposition, for those that are not familiar with it, is your official legal statement prior to trial, where you are pretty much locked in a room with your attorneys and the other side's attorneys, and everybody asks you questions, and all these notes you're taking. It's an official statement.
Yeah, you're given testimony before
absolutely.
The trial.
Yep, that is exactly what it is. Yeah. And so there's a lot on the line, and, you know, I'm required to, like, you know, basically practice what it is that I can and should be saying.
Because the phrasing is so important.
For sure. Yeah. And that was something that I didn't even quite understand until we got into it, how the phraseology in your very specific words are of the utmost importance. Like, you can say the same statement two different ways. In one way, implicates you in this horrific sense that is completely contrary to what your intended goal is. And the other way is like, ah, oh, there's no big deal. And a couple of the things that I remember them pointing out is, I mean, you all have heard the phrase ski porn before, of course. Mm-hmm. Like it is, you know, part of, it's an explanation of the genre that this is action sports, right? Like action sports porn, ski porn.
It's bike porn. It's every porn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, so one of their attorneys says like, ah, oh, so you would say that, you know, it says here on your website in this article from 4 years ago, you refer to one of your movies as ski porn. Did you write that? And it's like, well, no, but somebody that worked for me wrote it and we put it on the website. Okay. Mm-hmm. So would you say that you make ski porn? It's like, well, you know, to some extent that speaks to the genre of what we do. Okay. So you make porn. Well, no, that's not what I said. Well, no, you just said, it's like, no. You told me that I make porn. I said that I make ski films and people can refer to them in that genre. Moves on. So you are a pornographer.
Unfucking real.
It was insane, because what they're trying to do is paint a picture of me creating a product, level one, creating a product that is the antithesis of Warren Miller Entertainment's message and damaging to them. And if I'm a pornographer,
not very family friendly.
No. I'm a pornographer using Warren's name and likeness and whatever and voice, then clearly that's bad for the family.
How dare you?
Oh my God. Bad people. So that was one thing that really stood out, was this like fucked up twisting of words.
Mm.
And you know, there are two approaches that you can take in these situations. And we really wanted to take the higher ground. And it was like, we're going to just, you know, tell the truth as it is. And that will effectively set us free. And they just drug this whole thing through the gutter in their attempts to, like, you know, they talked about the premiere in Boulder and like referenced all these complaints. And it was just like, you guys fucking planted those people. Like, that has never happened before and will never happen again. Like, I had to call them out on it. And so,
yeah, it created every bit of ill will.
Yes.
Like, there was no ill will.
No.
On our side.
No. And so like the one of the cards that we kept in our back pocket was, of course, this woman, Kelly Bergelt, who had basically gone undercover and tried to like implicate us. It was entrapment, basically. It was entrapment. And that, again, could have gotten her disbarred. And she's sitting right across from me at this table in the deposition. And like, well, we're not going to bring this up unless and an if they like go south with this whole thing. And so, of course, at one point it's like, well, we're going to go there just to like explain to the other people in the room, like how this is actually being approached by Warren Miller Entertainment. So my attorney asked me, like, do you recognize anybody in this room from the opposing counsel?
Yeah.
It's like, well, yes, I do. Could you point to her? Could you tell us her name? Could you tell us where you have encountered her? Oh, yes. Like, I met her here. Well, can you please further elucidate the situation in which you guys crossed paths? And so I tell the whole story. She stands up in a huff and says that we are making all of this up. To which I respond that, you know, I've got a half dozen friends that were there at the time, and they can all recount this, you know, perfectly clearly as well. They're going to have the exact same story. She says something about us being like stoners and drunks and like stupid little kids that like we don't know what happened, and our testimony would never stand up in court. It's like, are you fucking kidding me, lady? Like, for one, I don't even smoke. For two, I was stone cold sober that night. I am probably more educated than you are, as are half the people on my team that were there that night. Like, how fucking dare you? But I mean, that's where they took it.
Yeah.
This crazy antagonistic through the gutter. It was pretty lame, man. It was very eye opening. I'd never been through anything like that before. Certainly no legal proceeding. I had no idea like the level of just like animosity and just like degradation that these people would be willing to go through to like flip the script on this.
Yeah.
Totally and bizarre.
Yeah. It was crazy.
Like, yeah. Dirty tactics for like, again, we're all making ski movies here. Like what is going on?
Yeah.
It's good practice for the divorce. I could cut that, but
no, you can leave it in there. It's fine. It's true. It's true, man. Yeah. When people get lawyers involved, it's just, It's nuts.
I mean, it's so unfortunate. That's literally the practice. That's what being a lawyer is. But yeah, that's what good lawyers do.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So where to go from there? Did it go to trial? Was there a trial?
Well, eventually, no, there was not a trial. It went back and forth for a long time. And ultimately, the further down the road we got, Warren Miller Entertainment was very much opposed to anything that was going to be public. There were a couple dates that Warren was scheduled to appear in front of a court in Denver.
Really?
And at the very last minute, they like shut that down and changed things and delayed and pushed things back. Because could you imagine 85-year-old Warren Miller?
The photos from that, jeez.
Testifying in federal court here in Denver would have been nuts.
Against his own company.
Yes, yes. And so eventually it went to an arbitration. There was some clause buried in one of these early contracts that said that they could go to arbitration. I think that Warren's hand was pretty much forced because he would have preferred to go to trial. Mm. Like, he didn't care about the legal fees, and he wanted his day in court to, like, you know, go full circle on this thing and blow it up.
Yeah.
And for me, I really didn't care either way. You know, we at that point were just kind of like moving on. And, you know, at a certain point in the middle of the winter, like every month or so, I'd get a call from the attorneys and just like some updates and have to answer some more questions or provide some more information. But I was kind of hands off. And eventually they went to this arbitration, and the arbitrators came up with an official ruling. And at the end of the day, the arbitrators ruled that any and all damage done by Warren Miller Entertainment was very specifically due to their own actions. Level one caused no damage, financial or otherwise, to Warren Miller Entertainment. I mean, it was clear as day. They fucked themselves, basically. Yeah. I mean, that was the language of the ruling. They also found that Warren should not. He was pushing the limits of what he had done, and that moving forward, he could not and should not give his name, voice, or likeness to what could be viewed as a potentially competing product, which
essentially a non-compete clause.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he can go and do an ad. He could probably have gone and done a blurb for
car commercial or whatever. Yeah, and I think that's one of the examples they gave. It's like he can go do stuff, but he cannot compete with Warren Miller Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, was at the end of the day, I think a very fair response and ruling, and probably cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and a lot of gray hair and headache and heartache on a lot of sides to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just ridiculous and a shame, and really a shame, because, you know, I think to this day, there's still these like repercussions that echo through, you know, Warren Miller Entertainment as far as the damage they did to their brand whenever this topic comes up. And what's really interesting, too, is that the arbitration was different and outside of the scope of this lawsuit. So that was very specifically addressing Warren and his relationship. However, the lawsuit continued to still be pending between Warren Miller Entertainment and Level One. They didn't drop it, which was absolutely ludicrous. I remember getting the call from Ben, and he's just like, well, so it's kind of odd. They didn't drop this. And if you don't work out some kind of settlement with them, or, you know, we don't start talking about this, like, this will go to trial. They will lose at trial, and they will just get like laughed out of the courtroom, but it'll probably cost you a couple hundred thousand dollars to do that.
Hello.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, for one, that's not even in the ballpark equation of like, I sell the fucking house at that point and all our cameras and Luca the Husky and whatever else, try to raise some money. But
a kidney.
Yeah, a couple kidneys. But so, I mean, that wasn't even like in the picture, but it was really odd that they didn't drop it. And what they wanted was some sort of public settlement where we would agree to all be friends and publicize it. And so they wrote, I think the final settlement offer, they wanted me to pay them like 10 grand or something like that, which they considered, I think, a nominal fee just to like, I was like, fuck no, that's not a nominal fee. That's a lot of money. Like, for one, I just can't afford that. So for one, there is no financial exchange whatsoever. Two, this weird statement that you wrote is not going to cut it. I will be happy to put out a statement, but I'm going to write it myself. You can all sign off on it, and you don't have editorial ruling over it, but I'm going to write my own statement because they wrote some weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, ultimately I wrote a statement. We put it out to the press and I signed it and we made it all go away. The really funny thing was, though, that the statement that I eventually wrote was, I mean, it was really like kind of dumbed down and whitewashed. But if you read between the lines, I was definitely calling them out. I got my last word in for sure.
Gonna have to go find that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of gems on the archive server. I found at like, I think a PDF of basically every email relating to this entire, to you setting it up, everything that happened around this voiceover that you probably had to submit as testimony.
There's
a lot. Were you going to say,
bless, I was going to say, bless their little hearts, as as they say in the South.
Yeah.
What's really funny, though, it just kind of all went away almost. And, you know, for a couple of years after, I'd still get calls and emails from people being like, yo, what happened with that? Because of the way that it just kind of like fizzled out, which was fine. Like, I didn't need some sort of like flashpoint announcement or like conclusion.
Courtroom verdict.
Yeah, exactly. But that was a saga unlike any other in our history for sure. And
I think within, Skeen too, it's pretty one of a kind and just bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, bizarre is the name.
Like, good job, Max Burby. Good job, WME.
So you said WME is owned by Time Warner, ABC?
Well, AOL, Time Warner at the time, and then they've sold at the time that this whole thing went down, AOL had sold them to, or whoever was in like that investment side of things, sold WME and Ski and Skiing and part of that group to Bonnier Corp, which was a Scandinavian like multinational multimedia conglomerate, which owned like billions of dollars worth of different brands and businesses. And this was just like this little side thing.
Yeah.
Really? You're nodding. Did you have anything to add? Is that right? I think
I heard ABC when you said AOL and I thought that means Disney. So I was like curious if there's something to talk about there, but it sounds like there's not.
No,
so
we Disney was involved in the 90s, but, not here. Yeah. Gotcha. Just Bonnier.
But the other thing that I guess it's kind of self-explanatory, but they had a bottomless fund to support this whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, and that was that's one of the things that created this whole David versus Goliath scenario, is that you know, again, we're home office and Cap Hill here in Denver, and like just billions of dollars to support the other side. And people picked up on that, and I think that's one of the reasons that they had our backs.
That was crazy.
Nuts.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, because without the public backlash, it sounds like this would have gone down a lot different. So, or could have, at least.
Well, I think...
Potentially.
I don't think that the final outcome would have changed. I think that, you know, we definitely benefited long-term for sure just from the recognition in the press and you know, people rallying to support our cause.
Well, they had motive to make it go away, though.
Yeah.
Come, you know, a few months later.
Right.
They certainly did. PR, PR-wise.
Yeah. Get the comms people in there shouting, like, this is bad. This isn't going well. Yeah.
So bad.
Anything else to add before we move on to a couple other things about the movie?
Thank you, Dave Moore and Greg Heidel, for connecting the dots and making that happen, because that's certainly one of the most exciting chapters of my life and something that I will never forget.
Anyway, cool. It was the only chance we had to meet Warren Miller.
Yeah.
It was we had a premiere in that November where we all went out and flew out to Seattle and he was at the show.
Sick.
Yeah. And
he saw the movie.
He saw the movie. So we did a collab premiere with this JK's movie, Swiss Island Deep.
That's John Clackwitz, by the way.
Yeah, and Warren was there, and we got to hang out with Warren at his office previous to this or before the screening, and it was really cool meeting him because my grandfather, Victor Cody, made movies in the 40s and 50s and 60s as well, like film skiing, and I was like, do you know this guy, Victor? And he's like, yeah, I know that.
No way.
I think
I was grandson.
Yeah.
I'm part of level one.
So, I mean, that was very much a generation that they were both a part of. So,
damn.
Yeah.
Josh, you mentioned you wanted to touch on the movie's title. Where'd Refresh come from?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the context of everything else, is probably one of the least exciting things. But I just remember having a conversation with Friedel. We were at Brighton on a chairlift. And we've been talking about movie titles for a while. And I think we very much wanted to just address the fact that we were 10 years deep refreshing continuously our perspective on skiing and what was going on in the sport and our approach to filmmaking. And I think that it was just on a list. I don't remember if it was your list or my list, but I remember
there's some parallel thinking there.
Yeah. But I just remember being together on the chairlift and it's like refresh. It's puking snow. Hell of a pow day.
Yeah.
Right.
Get the refresh
the
coming
double
through.
Entendre.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've actually never realized that until now. So. That makes it much cooler.
Yeah.
Yeah. More than just like broad. Yeah. Anyway.
But I don't think it's a particularly deep title.
No, it's definitely not. But it's just like a moment in time that I definitely remember.
Yeah.
And in the context of everything else, it's this is a cool little add-on because, yeah.
We literally just had a listener question come in while we've been recording this. A good one, I think. Yeah. David Baird wants to know, always thought the shot of Casaubon getting towed in by the dogs was funny. Was that a filler clip or did he actually get speed from that?
That's a great question.
Definitely got speed. Watch the movie.
Yeah. It's not faked. We were at the Olympics. So that was that trip that I did in March with Tom Mullish, Phil Casaubon, and Corey Vanuler was on kind of a comeback from a bunch of injuries. And so we invited him along on that one.
Yep.
We were at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, and we were filming that drop rail there. And this guy was walking his dog, which was like a pit bull.
A hoss of a dog.
Beast dog.
Yeah, like almost an American bulldog style, maybe a pit bull boxer mix or something like that. I forget what this guy's name, Yoshi or something. I was like friends with him on Facebook for a while. He was like, oh man, this is awesome. He's like, I think it was his idea where he was like, yo, like my dog's got tons of energy. Like you should try pulling him in. And you didn't need that much speed. So there's plenty of shots where we have, or he's like, he is rallying the dog. So he's like running ahead of the dog going, go, 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 go. And the dog, you know, Wallace and Casaubon both did this.
Mm-hmm.
They grabbed on the dog's leash and they pull him in. And it gives you ample speed to hit that drop rail because you don't need much. You're sliding for like a short distance and then falling away.
Yeah.
And I just remember being like, we got a short window of time where this dog is going to have enough energy to do that. You know, only the dog is going to run out of gas.
Yeah.
So it was like, and the owner was totally down for doing it as long as it, and I was like, I need to get a shot of the, you know, a shot of from below the rail. And then I was like, it's Phil, it's B dog, you know, that's what he goes by. This
going
is like
wild.
The peak B dog, you know, that's like literally what you call him. And I was like, I got to get a shot of him, like, you know, from like a POV perspective and all of this stuff. So I was like running around, like while this dog still had energy, try to get every cutaway. But there was at least two, three, four tries where both Phil and Wallace got pulled in and slid the rail from that dog.
Sick.
And it was the coolest little moment.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, like, what the fuck is this? Is like amazing. Like, this is the, you know, the illest way to get speed for a rail, period.
Yeah.
And, I mean, maybe, like, the shot of Phil's actual make is, like, spliced with the in-run. I don't know exactly. But I know, watching those shots, that they did have makes on that feature with the dog giving them the speed.
Sick.
And then, yes, eventually the dog ran out of gas, as is to be expected. And
they're back to just pole pushing
into
the rail.
And they're back to pole pushing into that thing. Because it had a gentle incline.
Right.
But, holy shit, it was like, what the fuck that just happened? That is priceless, dude. And then that guy, like, he friended me on Facebook and he's like really wanted to see the movie when it came out. Yeah, it was like, you know, his star turn, or at least the dog's
star. Yeah, 15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, it still sticks to this day as being a really interesting shot.
Like, yeah. Hell yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
So thanks for bringing that to our attention, David.
Mm-hmm. Another one from Sherwood. This is a quick clarification, but he's heard us talking about going to Red Mountain in real time and wanted to know if you ever shot in Telluride itself or if you were just in that area regionally.
That was regional. Sold out. Regional. Just not trying to blow up spots, I think. There are definitely a number of instances over the years where we're going to, you know, mislabel a location intentionally just for the sake of not blowing it up. And I think that's just like, you know, filmer, movie maker protocol.
Cool.
Yeah. But, you know, San Juan's, Southern Colorado, Southwest Colorado, mm-hmm. Telluride, close enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Word.
We have shot in Telluride too, though.
Ooh. Give, yeah. When,
a few
where?
Times. So, I mean,
because that's the real question there he's asking is like, did you actually go to Telluride?
Not,
and shoot
not that
there?
Year.
I did okay. Some shooting in Telluride area the next year, 2010, okay. With right. DeLorme and who else was there? Spacing right now, but yeah.
I just remember the DeLorme shots. Maybe Bibby or something?
Could have been.
I don't know. But, or Downey?
Oh,
the crew
Amet.
Made it there.
It's Amet.
Amet. That's right. Yeah.
Amet and DeLorme. Mm. Yeah, we were doing like a road trip around Southwest Colorado trying to find some new zones.
Cool.
Yeah.
I actually went
there's
to
a lot of town there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went to spend some time in Telluride proper after dark year a couple years later, yeah. Working with Telluride Heli Tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was all right.
Heli skiing.
Yeah.
Safe. This did not come in an email with someone posted on New Schoolers, but I think we should, it's worth discussing. Colin Garnes was just watching Turbo and wonder what the hell happened to Stephen Thomas.
Ah, yeah. I think I saw that one come through.
Mm-hmm.
Watching. Well, I mean, he did not end in Turbo. He had an opener, long story short, the closer in Turbo. So he filmed less for this movie, but he still filmed for Refresh. He did some trips to Baker, I think, with Josh and mm-hmm. Bibby and those guys. And then he put all his eggs in the Alaska basket.
Mm.
So he at that point had like fully graduated to trying to ski lines and, you know, less about trying to do switch fives and whatnot.
Yeah.
He went to Haynes with, myself, Wiley Miller and, 16-year-old Duncan Adams.
Oh, right. Duh. He's in the Paradise segment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that, and he had some other shots as well, but yeah, I mean, he killed it in Haynes. He's a great skier. Like, I love watching Stefan ski. But when he had some other shots as well outside of Haynes, but when it came to the edit, we had to, like, cut out a couple other shots just because it didn't really have a place in the movie and there's so much other stuff going on. I remember being like, dude, your role is kind of, like, stuck, like, in Alaska. And he's like, dude, I don't give a shit. He's like,
that's where I want to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, he totally has a role in Refresh, just not a feature part. But then moving on from that, I think he would have loved to continue doing trips, film trips to Alaska, but money was certainly becoming an issue. He was never like a super highly paid skier, and paying out of pocket for heli trips, even snowmobile trips.
Yeah.
That's pretty expensive. And I think he's a really smart dude.
Mm.
And I think he quickly was like, the risk reward thing was not quite worth it. Or certainly like paying your way as like a pro skier and trying to do what he was doing was getting
prohibitively expensive and risky.
Yeah. So he, Stefan, there was no like fall off point. I think he was like, yeah, I'm going to go back to school and get a degree. And he's done some, I think, chemistry degrees. Is that what he's doing or has been doing?
Biochem or something like that. I mean, yeah. He's very educated.
Egghead shit.
Yeah, and he's still, he still skis quite a bit. He's like a big-time Wasatch ski tour guy, and he rock climbs a buttload.
Nice.
And still a great dude. I mean, I always would love to see him ski. And I felt like there was like a void when he stopped filming with us just because he had like such a distinct, unique style.
Mm-hmm.
Still miss it. And I still love watching his old footage, but that's to answer that question. no major
word
drop off, but just kind of, yeah.
Making the transition.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, you know, at this
point, the story of most of these where did they go type things, I would imagine.
Right. I mean, you know, the last couple of movies, we've been talking a lot about Steel Spence and Travis Redd and even Vanular.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, like nothing lasts forever.
No.
And this is the generational shift where, yeah, there's like, I think, two decades of Level One, and one decade is represented by different dudes. And that's where Refresh is certainly starting to illustrate
turning
that.
The page.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Different talent, different people, not just dudes, I should say. But, yeah.
Skiers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People.
Really quick on the topic of Alaska, that particular trip, that's when that whole Easter.
Yeah.
Miracle.
Yeah.
Round one of several.
It was a pretty spicy situation that they got into. I mean, Haines, Alaska can be a volatile place. With those mountains are wild. I mean, all of Alaska, you're getting dropped off by a helicopter onto some pretty crazy ass terrain, for lack of better adjectives. But
yeah,
we were totally green to that experience. Haines is like such a mecca, and like such a, and it already had a crazy reputation for really cool footage and ski place.
Yeah.
And we were lucky to go there. I think that Jeff Kicker, Cricko, the photographer, had linked up a deal with a guide, and we could get in with Heliop. So we did. We all flew up there. Yeah, again, Wiley, Miller, Stephen Thomas, and Duncan Adams, who, again, was only 16, quite young, but was already proven himself as a great skier. And myself, which was, as I said in the movie, a dream come true, and it totally was a dream come true. And, yeah, we went up, and the very first day we flew, I think we flew the next day after we got there. This is in mid-April. And it was Easter Sunday, and those guys, Cricko and I, were left at the airport helipad. They flew out with the guides, and Wiley, Steph, and Duncan land on a ridge that's going to be their very first line in Haines.
Mm-hmm.
And Duncan and Stephen get out of the helicopter along with the guide. Wiley Miller is stepping out. Whole cornice breaks away. Worst case scenario, like absolute nightmare scenario, Alaska situation where you're landing on cornices. And Wiley, you know, is on the skid, and he sort of like didn't want to scare the heli pilot. But
yeah,
because, you know, the thing you learn in briefing is like, don't fuck with the heli pilot, especially, you know, in collective situations where they need to keep the ship very steady.
Yeah.
He told them to pull off. They pull off. Stefan and Duncan got washed down in this debris. The guide was hanging on where it cracked, so he was still up on the ridge. And
holy shit.
Yeah.
Very fortunately, usually what happens when a cornice drops is that there's so much weight that it'll release a snowpack secondary avalanche, even when there's not high avalanche danger.
Right.
If that had happened.
Catastrophic.
Yeah. And especially since there was, you know, further down below, like these Bergschrunds, these like Ketchermit zones where the glacier meets the slope.
Giganto crevasse.
Yeah. They most likely would have gotten washed into that. And they did claim their backpacks and stuff that rolled down into that stuff. But, I mean, those guys were 100% okay. And
a little shook, perhaps.
Yeah.
Incredibly shook, dude. We just, and you know, I did not experience this firsthand. Back at the heliport, just hear the radio call come in, like something just happened, and you're like, what just happened? And then they, you know, come back that everything's fine. They picked them up. They all fly back. And I've never seen so much nicotine intake. Everyone is just standing around, like, trying to, you know, doing a debriefing,
anything
essentially.
To take the edge off.
Anything to take the edge off. People that haven't smoked a cigarette in 20 years, like, are just, like, even just, like, not even firsthand a part of this situation. We're just, like, but, I mean, yeah, it was the best case scenario for a worst case scenario. And the craziest thing to happen for your very first time. But that, I think, was, like,
your
such
first
a
day?
Good,
oh, my
very
God.
Very first day. And, like, but such a good illustrator as to what can happen. I mean, that shit.
Reality check for sure.
As good as, like, the guides are, as good as anyone can be, little shit can happen like that. That's not little shit at all.
Yeah.
But, holy,
it's a little mistake that turns
fuck.
Into a big consequence.
Massive, yeah. Massive wake-up call to what that place is like. Very real. And, I mean, even secondhand, it was very real. So, that was Easter Sunday. And to this day, we have this, like, weird – I have a weird relationship with Easter Sundays, which is always during peak filming season.
Right.
But I have, like, a superstition about it for sure. I don't
do you not film on Easter Sundays?
I try not to. And there's been, like, miscellaneous stuff that has happened on Easter Sundays over the years. But Krikko and I always talk about it because, like, one year – I think I was up in Revelstoke a couple years ago, and my sled broke down on Easter Sunday.
Mm.
And I had video of us towing it out, and he, like, texted me. He's like, fucking Easter Sunday, man.
Mm.
And I was like, I know.
Should have stayed home today.
Yeah.
Scary.
But, yeah, I mean, that trip turned out to be, like, completely fucking awesome for us. And, like,
what was it like getting back out there the next run after that had just happened? Was everybody just, like, rattled and scared? Or?
I can't speak for Stefan and Duncan. For sure they were.
Yeah.
And including the guides, and everybody was rattled and scared. And I think we were just being like, all right, like, fucking noted. Like, cornices are the most dangerous thing in the world.
Yeah.
And again, there wasn't, like, a high avalanche risk or anything like that. So we didn't have, like, a lot of other frightful moments. But we got back at it because the weather was good, and I think we flew, like, our first 4 days there. And they jumped right back on the horse pretty hard.
Good for fucking them.
Yeah, yeah, dude. And,
I can't,
like,
fathom
I honestly
that
don't know. Yeah, it had been – it's kind of like you get the most scariest thing that's going to happen to you, like, out of the way first. And it's such in a lot of ways just, like – I don't know. Yeah, that's what happened, and everything else is, like, you're more alert, but also more respectful, but also, like, yeah, just appreciative of the situation a little more. So, I had a second chance to do it again. So, you either bail completely on that, or you get back out and do it again, and fight your fears. And they certainly did. It was like a crazy ass time that we won't, you know, first impressions are everything, man. So I have a crazy first impression of Alaska, but, it'll leave a double mark.
I'm glad you asked about that, Josh, because I was asking you about this trip yesterday, just, like, picking your brain about all the heli stuff and, like, how your first time, and you did not mention this.
Casual omission.
Yeah. Damn.
Huh. But, of course, the part in the movie doesn't reflect any of that. It's me, mouth. Like, with a selfie cam. So, yeah.
Yeah. In particular, this... the spine lines that I think all three of them ski it, but it's Wiley's Ender that end up being the cover of the movie too.
Sexy, like, spines. It's a
classic.
A classic. A Haynes classic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lives up to the name.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I also ate shit skiing down from that. That was, you get to ski if you're put on these barbecue angles is what we call them, like where you're shooting long lines across a valley in Alaska at these lines. You eventually, the helicopter doesn't pick you up. You have to ski down to the pickup.
Mm-hmm. The heli picked me up from some of them.
Josh got valet service.
Skiing the conditions you had, the turbo year with a camera pack, I would not have
wanted
to do that.
Dude, we were also like, I was deposited on this, like, 3,000 vertical foot, like, just cliff. I mean, there should have was no way down. It was like, you were being deposited here.
Yeah, if you're
I spent like an entire afternoon there because we were sharing the heli. It was not a private ship. But yeah, I mean, that was definitely a situation. As there were some others as well where I was super gripped. I never actually was like, I can't ski this, but there are definitely like situations where Krikko and I were just picked up because there was no way down.
Yeah. I mean, Krikko and I skied down and he was basically the guide because he had been in some capacity like in guide school. But immediately you're faced with a huge convex rollover and you're looking down at a glacier and it's steep as fuck. And it's like, oh my God. Like what this is like.
It's terrifying because you have no idea what's under it.
Yeah.
No.
And you have a huge pack back on with a tripod. So you're so top heavy. So you inch over these convex rolls and it's super dark too because it's in the evening and they are skiing in the sun. We're in the shade.
Right.
And there's you make it over the convex roll, but I got into some avi debris, or like not even avi debris, like some bad snow, like slough debris.
Yeah.
Down at lower, going pretty fast, top heavy, and ate so much shit and so dark.
Yeah.
That flat light. And I tomahawked so bad. And I was like, well, I got that out of the way. Like, that's my first like Alaskan tomahawk with a camera pack on. And I was like, I don't think anyone saw it. So I was like, yeah, that's nice to get out of the way, like on private time.
Yeah.
While your selfie cam wasn't rolling. You weren't life sinking when you went down.
No, that was all out at the harbor. But yeah, man. I mean, that refresh was a huge, I mean, I was talking about it before, but like probably one of my top, absolutely bar none, my top filming season. I felt like I went everywhere and did a lot of stuff, you know, including like France and all these places. But it was also the year, and I think the last year I can really make this claim, where I was like, I did a street trip, film park, you know, multiple street trips, film park, and, you know, did this like big mountain trip to Alaska. And I was like, the whole package. I was like very proud of that at the time. Like, not a lot of other people, I think, can say that, like, on either side of the lens. So,
sick. Yeah,
cool ass movie, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. 3 hours and change later.
3 hours deep?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Marathon of a chat here, boys.
Yeah. Well worth the time.
That was episode 10, level 20. Holy shit, what a marathon that was, but hope you enjoyed. As always, rate us on iTunes, go pre-order Romance, go buy your tickets to a premiere, go host your own premiere, and tell your friends about the podcast if you enjoyed. Send us in questions, podcast@level1productions.com. We already recorded iTrip and After Dark, but if you've got questions for Sunny or anything after, send them on in. We want to hear them. Thanks for listening, y'all. See you next week. I'm gonna sit